Good evening. We will call this meeting to order. It is 5:30. And if you've looked at your schedule, and I'm sure you have, we have the airport. They are up first. And Mike Hall is here at the back table. And Roxanne Noble is in the audience. Mike is ready to begin his presentation. Welcome, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. It's a pleasure to be here this evening to talk with you about our Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport. I'd like to break the presentation up like this. I want to start with a big picture because I think as an enterprise unit, not everyone is as familiar with some of the issues that affect the airport. And then we'll go through the 2015 budget. Recommended budget recap with particular focus on the OTR because that's something that's different within the budget. And I want to talk about some options and also an exit strategy because I think that you're probably aware that we've asked for a waiver of the county administrative fee for a period of 3 years to apply to the airport budget. I'm going to take a quick look at 2015 projects and acquisitions, and then a little bit of a word about strategy going forward. So I'll start with the bottom line. Our business is down 25% in the last 3 years, and there are a number of reasons for that, starting with the fact that we're serving a very unstable market. It really begins with the airlines and the fact that only a few years ago there were six major airlines, not including Southwest and JetBlue. And of those six, they've merged to three, or they're in the process of merging to three. It's hard to appreciate what a difficult process this is unless you recognize that everything an airline does is according to a set of operation specs or a cookbook that they have. And everybody's cookbook is different. So when you put two airlines together, you've got this massive bureaucratic administrative job that really consumes a great deal of their time and attention. And so it's been that first down the road was Northwest and Delta became Delta. Next up, United and Continental become United. And last, American and U.S. Airways become American. And we're kind of stuck in the middle of all this. How does it affect us? Well, it affects us in several ways, but principally a lot of poor service reliability. And the reason for that is very much human nature. If you think about United Airlines, which is the really poor performer right now, their energy is consumed trying to pull two airlines together and get that one set of ops specs and operate. They don't fly into Ithaca. Who flies into Ithaca is a contract carrier that has United Airlines' name on the side of it. And those contract carriers are in a constant state of turmoil. They also have been subject to mergers and acquisitions and business failures in the past few years. So we don't even get the mainline attention, if you will. We get the contract carrier. And those of you that are in business know that's one step removed. And, you know, you may try to hold your contractor's feet to the fire, but it's not necessarily that easy. And they're a little bit further from your visibility. The second thing is the hubs. Back about a decade ago, we revamped air service into Ithaca. And in the process, we wound up with two of our three destinations being on the East Coast corridor, subject to all the ills of traffic and weather that are associated with the East Coast corridor. And those two hubs are Philadelphia and Newark. You can't find two worse airports. And one of the simple reasons to grasp is the fact that under some weather conditions that recur fairly regularly, both those airports go from two-runway operation to single-runway operation. Well, the schedule is sized for two runways. So you can imagine when you go from two runways to one runway, things start backing up. And if you've tried to fly out of here to either of those destinations, you know that the reliability is not what you want. There's also been consolidation in the services that are required to operate Ithaca, for example, both Delta and United, two competitors, are managed by the same company, Delta Global Services, which is a derivative of Delta Airlines. So just one more example where we tried to roll things up and make it work, but it's difficult. And you add all that together, and you get way too high unacceptable cancellation rates on certain flights. And we're working to turn that around, but there's a limited amount of flexibility in doing that. We also face a challenge of a gauge change. Many of you remember the 19-seat Beechcrafts. Haven't seen them for a while. You know, and then it got to be 25-seat de Havillands. Well, now we're up to 50-seat regional jets. And we're about to go to 70-seat regional jets. So if we want to keep our same frequency of service, we have to get 25% more people on each airplane. Just one of them, another challenge that we face out there. A 50-seat airplane at an 80% load factor is 40 people. A 70-seat airplane at an 80% load factor is 56 people. And if we don't get up to that load factor, which is kind of the standard that we're looking for, then we'll get more consolidation, which means there'll be fewer flights. And it becomes kind of a death spiral here that we need to avoid. The other challenge we have is customer loyalty. Back in 1977, my friend and mentor, Professor Alfred Kahn, went to the CAB and deregulated the airline industry. And the shockwaves of that are still passing through the industry. It's one of the things that's driving the airline mergers and consolidation. But it also turned the airline business from a kind of a business where you could have local influence into a commodity with a spot market. And in the old days when there was Mohawk Airlines here, we were able to sit down with Mohawk Airlines and negotiate fares in and out of Ithaca. And it was kind of a stable situation. Today, if you took your computer right now and tried to book a trip, say a month from now, and looked for the lowest price, you'd find a price, and it might be at Ithaca, it might be at Binghamton, it might be at Syracuse, it might be at Allentown. It might surprise you that all of those airports have the same average fare over a period of time. But the spot fares differ. So if you are an individual who's shopping price, and you make that reservation right now, you might decide you're going to fly out of Binghamton because the spot price for the tickets you're after was cheapest at Binghamton. If you do it an hour later, you'll probably come up with a different result. So it's important to understand that the market we're dealing with is a commodity market with a spot component to it, just like the stock market. And unfortunately, Professor Kahn's no longer here, but I have a suspicion that maybe that's what he wanted, you know, to get it to be like the stock exchange. So we have a problem with customer loyalty that we have to address. Here are the people that do the addressing. This is a standard slide out of the budget package. We got 15 FTEs out there and about an equal number of close contractors. Close contractors doesn't include the rental car folks, but it is the people who do some cleaning. It's our ambassadors who do security, those kind of people. So it's about a 30 FTE business, half of whom are county employees. The budget that was recommended this year is down by a little over 6%, reflecting the fact that business is down. But remember, we have fixed cost and variable cost. And in a $3 million budget, about two-thirds of our cost is variable, but a third of it is fixed in the form of people. And you can't adjust people because of the length of day that you have to cover with crash, fire, rescue, and other essential services to keep the airport open. So we don't have an ability to scale our operation exactly with the market. The key part of the budget, I think from your point of view and certainly from ours, is an over-target request for $125,900 or $126,000, which reflects the administrative fee charged to the airport by the county for services provided. And we're asking that that be waived for 3 years. When this proposal was first put forth, there was a focus on trying to reduce the fees that we pass on to the airlines for using the airport, because that's been a bone of contention with them during negotiations about service in Ithaca. We're starting to relook that, and we're certainly going to be back talking to you about this subject in the weeks and months ahead. We're relooking it because 125.9 is a bit of a drop in the bucket when it comes to rates and charges. It's maybe 5% of the total. And while that's a nice tip of the hat, it's not really economically fundamental to the airlines. And we've been meeting personally with the airlines, and in those discussions, the airlines are more interested in what we're interested in. They want to get passengers back in the airplanes because that's where they really make some money. So for that reason, in the reduction in rates and charges is one option that we've talked about so far, but we're beginning to take a look at how we might invest that 125.9 in a strategy that would turn around, help us turn around the business and get us back where we were a few years ago. And I mentioned that we've gotten together with the airlines to discuss rates and charges and other issues. Had a good meeting with Delta in September. United Airlines is up next week. And we've had good communication with American Airlines. And the conclusion that we've come to from these meetings is both we and they think that revenue is more important than charges. So if we decided to invest some of that money, here are some things that we might want to take a look at. One is a market analysis. You can imagine, again, that if you're in headquarters of United Airlines out in Chicago and you're managing service into Ithaca, you don't know a whole lot about Ithaca unless you happen to be one of the few that went to Cornell. So we are well positioned through an air service consultant. Some of you have met him, Ewan Barr. He's a retired airline vice president. And through a huge data pool that we have access to from Boyd Associates, put those two things together, and we have an opportunity to know our market better than anybody else knows our market. And that's pretty powerful because when you go in to talk with the airlines, you know, it becomes an immediate negotiation and discussion of market. And if you know more than they do, you have an advantage in that discussion. One of the huge things that's happened recently with air service data is after a number of years of contracting with Boyd and getting a quarterly report about how traffic was doing at Ithaca and some of the surrounding airports, we recently convinced them to open up their entire data bank to us because in Ewan, and I've got several Cornell business students now coming to work with Ewan as analysts, we have an opportunity with that entire database to really figure out some interesting ideas. How so? Well, if you look at the Southern Tier airports and air service, if you look at the Southern Tier airports and overall activity, Ithaca's number one because we have a strong general aviation component here with the Gannick Airlines and East Hill Flying Club. If you look at air service, airline service, which is the thing that we're usually most focused on, we are number two. Elmira's number one. If you look at air service of the big three we talked about in consolidation, everybody's off a comparable amount. The only reason that Elmira is ahead of us is because they were clever enough to get Allegiant Airlines in there. And I don't know if any of you have flown with Allegiant, but they have a new business paradigm for the airlines. Most airlines buy a bunch of airplanes, and they fly them 6 days a week and do maintenance one day a week. And, you know, whether you need it or not on Saturday, the airplane's going to fly because that's the way they do business. What Allegiant's done is they've broken that paradigm, and they fly twice a week. And they don't fly to main airports. They fly to outlying airports, which is easier and cheaper from their point of view. One of the things we're going to use Ewan and the Park Fellows for with access to this data, and we've already had a nibble from Delta Airlines, is to go to day-of-week flying, not with Allegiant, but one of the existing carriers here. Supposing Delta were to fly to Atlanta twice a week. If Delta were to fly to Atlanta every day, it wouldn't work. there probably isn't enough traffic. But when you talk about trying to move away from those hubs that I talked about, to get back to where we were when we went to Pittsburgh, right? That was great. But politically, Pittsburgh lost out to Philly, and that's where U.S. Air goes, and Continental United is Newark. And so when you go back to the reality that air service is not reliable, and that's the reason a lot of people aren't flying out of Ithaca, and what you're going to do about it, we have to look at analyzing the data, making a marketing presentation, and using that data to help change our destinations. For example, how about Charlotte and Kennedy? And if you want to pick a couple places to go. Both of them are far more accessible. Both of them have a lot of connections, and they don't have the problems that Newark and Philadelphia do. So we'll be doing some work in this area, and maybe that's a good investment for some of the 125.9. Advertising and promotion, we are out of date. We're not as out of date as the county is when it comes to IT, but we're out of date. And the reason is that we don't have good integration between social media and the website, and we've got to fix that this year so that information that's posted one place is posted every place, is broadcast out to people, because that's where it's at. And in a commodity spot market, that's one of the ways you can increase, you can encourage people to work out of Ithaca. Our admin assistant at the airport traveled out. She's a new grandmother last week. She traveled to Indiana or to the St. Louis area, and she couldn't get out of Ithaca, so she went out of Syracuse. Well, she came back to a parking bill that was nearly $100. And we need to help people understand that if you want to shop Walmart and go for low price and you're going to Syracuse to get it, there are some hidden costs that you may not have thought of, and that message needs to be hammered again and again. And finally, we've got some issues with airport reliability. We have a single ILS, which goes down periodically, and when it does, if the weather's bad, there's a problem of servicing Ithaca. We also have an automatic weather report, and when it goes down, we didn't have anybody backing it up, no person backing it up. And so last year we lost too many flights because the airlines can't operate without somebody telling them it's a good day. I mean, you could go outside today and it's a good day. If you don't have an official weather report, they can't fly. So we're trying to backstop with our people some of those holes that cause us to be less reliable. That's taking charge of those things that we can affect. I guess the last thing I would say that doesn't necessarily fit right here is holding the airlines accountable. I had a situation the other day where I went down and the United flight had canceled to Newark, and I found the station manager. Remember, the station manager is a contractor to United, and he actually works for Delta. And I walked into the office, and he was looking at the computer, and I said, "Why'd the flight to Newark cancel?" He says, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, that's not an acceptable answer. I want to know why it canceled." He says, "Well, why don't you call the President of United?" So I said, "Well, when General Hall calls the President of United, he might take the call, and if he does, I'll mention you." Well, at that, at least he turned away from the computer. And since then, I've gotten emails whenever the flight cancels. You know, it's what gets measured, gets managed, and if you can just cancel and nobody cares, why wouldn't you cancel? Your life just got easier. So we got some challenges like that we need to address as an airport. It's not our airline, but it's our reputation. And right now, United Airlines is ruining our reputation and theirs, and that needs to be fixed. That's another reason why I might want to move away from giving them a break on rates and charges this year. Let's have them earn it. So however we decide, and this decision will be a joint decision, we'll be back to you on this after the situation matures a little bit. However we decide to go, there needs to be an exit strategy. And this exit strategy speaks to the fact that if we go back to where we were in 2010, a 25% increase in business, and you split it, according to the formula, 75-25 between the airlines and the airport, that amounts to about a $600,000 impact, which is $450,000 reduction in airline fees, which is significant. That's not 5%. That's a significant reduction. And an increased airport revenue of $150,000 versus the $125.9 that is, you know, is on the table right now. So I wanted to leave you with the notion that there could be a light at the end of the tunnel. It's not the train, and we can build our way out of this if we invest wisely. Upcoming major projects, big deal, terminal expansion. Easiest way to understand what's going on here is when you go to most other airports, you check in at a counter, and your bag disappears behind the counter through the wall, and you pick it up, hopefully, at your destination. In our case, that new scanning machine, which is tremendous because people don't have to go through the bags by hand, is out in front of the counter. And so the airport expansion really builds some behind-the-scenes space that allows us to handle security in a much more efficient and normal manner. When the current terminal was built, remember, that was way pre-9/11, and security was a whole different world back then. And then it improves some traffic flow and the actual checkpoint that you go through to get out to the gates. And when we get closer on this, we'll be asking for an opportunity to brief you specifically about it. The other thing that's going to happen is runway overlay. Now you say, well, it's no big deal. You know, we're going to pave the runway. Well, it is a big deal because we're going to have to shut the airport down perhaps for a week. And that impacts some of our great tenants like Teganic, who bases airplanes here, and they need to go on an on-call basis. It impacts the airlines. And we just began scoping this, and our engineering company, CNS in Syracuse, is going to come back to us with four different options that we might consider to see if see which one works best for our stakeholders. And we'll have meetings with you, we'll have meetings with the Air Service Board, and we'll have meetings with everybody at the airport to see if there's consensus around, is it better to pave at night for a longer period of time, or is it better to shut everything down and have at it for a week, et cetera. So the runway overlay theoretically could happen next summer, but probably not. And the reason is everybody wants to pave in the summer, and by the time we get the money to do it, it's going to be tough to get a contractor lined up and actually do it while Cornell's out of session, and et cetera, et cetera. The terminal expansion, on the other hand, could very well happen next summer. En route right now is a apron expansion. That's been approved by the legislature. It's more runway pavement. Right? It's more ramp pavement to allow us to better handle the de-icing of airplanes during the winter. And we also need to buy a new snowblower. And then someplace out there, one of those crash trucks is waiting for a grant. And then the terminal expansion will perhaps handle this, but we also have requested a state grant, which we don't know the outcome of, because this year the governor is holding all of the state grants until right before the election. So we should probably know in a month or so if we have the money. We will know in a month or so if we have the money. And here are some things that have to happen to our infrastructure at the airport, which is aging. You wouldn't want to be up on the roof of the crash fire rescue building because it's got some soft spots, and you know, it's going to have to be fixed. So those things are coming down the pike. Again, we'll get back together to talk about them when it's appropriate. So, look, in terms of going forward, we're in an unstable market. We need to be agile as an organization. I told you this evening there may be some changes proposed about how we handle the 125.9 OTR. That won't be the last you'll hear of changes throughout the year, but our commitment is that we'll work through government operations and the legislature to keep you informed and make appropriate decisions, and some of them may require a certain amount of agility. We're very fortunate. If you think you can run a business or an airport in this day and age and not have a board of directors helping you, you've got another thing coming. And we have two boards of directors. We have the legislature, which is our primary board, and we have the Air Services Board, which includes many of the business leaders and stakeholders in the community. And when you're done with the consultation and advice of those two bodies, you're in a much better position to make an informed and accurate decision. So just to know we're very, very much...
Mike, we're losing you. Can you come a little closer to the microphone?
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay.
Fine.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay.
The whole last part where you were talking about how wonderful I am, and missed it.
I'm sorry.
I mean, anyone have any questions, please?
Leslie's on the Air Services Board, and she's wonderful. So, questions?
After hearing, I have Carol and Dooley, but let me just make one comment. After hearing your anecdote about calling American Airlines, I will call you General from now on. So I have Carol Chalk and Dooley Kiefer. Go ahead, and then Mike Lane.
I think it was United.
What's that?
United?
Yes, it's United.
Or whatever.
Get our airlines.
That wasn't the name of the airline.
Although I bet it could happen with any of them. I believe that we need to, that in order to stay competitive in today's air travel world, we need to do this. We're going to need to spend money to do it, and that there are many communities out there who do spend money. I have two questions, though. I'm not understanding that the budget, that the revenues are down. If you look at packet page, was it section 4, page 3, mm-hmm. which is the airport page, and then the pages after that, the revenues section from 2014 to 2015 doesn't look like it's down. So I'm not under, I just want to understand that without that being a commentary on whether this is needed.
I brought Roxanne along this evening because I didn't build this budget. And Roxanne, do you want to take the first crack at that?
I might be able to help here.
She's looking.
I might be able to help here, too.
Okay.
Carol, what page are you looking at?
Three.
Page three? Okay. So the way this budget was structured, and this budget was prepared by Bob Nicholas, and it was an austerity approach to the budget. So you see that there is a reduction on the expense side of the $125,992. That's our administrative fee that is going down. That's why there's a reduction in expenditures. At that point, and as this budget was being constructed, the benefit of that reduction accrued fully to the airlines and the folks who pay fees and charges out there. That's why there's a reduction in those revenues at the bottom. That's the revenues that would otherwise come from them. What Mike is saying today is that as we talk to the airlines and think about the better strategy to get ourselves back to where we were before, we may want to reallocate the benefit of that savings. So as we go on in the next few months probably and really develop a strategy on how to deal with our situation, it's likely we're going to come back and ask for budget adjustments to the budget that you're looking at right now that might allocate differently that $126,000 in waived fees that are part of this budget.
So I understand that. I'm just not understanding how you get from the 2014 revenues of $2,982,000 to a target of $2,925,000 without – that looks like an increase. So I'm not understanding how the – then you're taking the
$125,000 down. It's a starting decrease from 14 to 15, and then it goes down further by that 126. And again, that the assumption that was behind that is that would be less revenue we would receive from the airlines and others who pay into those fees and charges.
Okay.
Carol, why don't
I... numbers still don't add, but that's okay.
It's a good question. You have to remember this is a little bit of a funny budget in the sense that it balances revenues and expenditures. There's no profit in here. And so you have to look at it a little bit differently than you look at a private sector business, even though we are an enterprise unit and essentially a private sector business. That may be someplace related to your comment, but I'll get with you.
More importantly, I think tell me why this strategy will work if we – Binghamton and Elmira all need to increase our ridership by 25% in order to stay in existence. How do we manage to have success I mean, I'd much rather fly from Ithaca, and I think anybody who's ever been through our airport can't help but prefer to fly in our clean, beautiful airport. But I'm not in today's air travel. I don't see fares going down. I don't see expenses to airlines going down. I see lots of people taking the bus to, you know, to New York.
Right.
So how are we going to be able to be successful is what I'm not...
Well, we were successful in operating at the level we need to recover to as recently as 2010. And we think that there's been significant leakage from airport ridership for particularly because of the lack of reliability of service. So our whole focus is on trying to become a more reliable airport. And an airport that does just as you suggest. It's a friendly place to go. And you want to fly out of Ithaca. Those are the two prongs of trying to get people back. I met with Dean Dutta from the business school, and he says, I'll help you with students, but I'm not going to fly out of Ithaca because when I go someplace, I have to get there. And, you know, too often I'm canceled going to Newark or whatever. When we fix that, he'll fly out of Ithaca. And we believe we have the opportunity to fix that.
Okay.
Julie Kiefer.
Thank you.
Please use the microphone.
Yes. I'm looking at appendices in our budget, which you probably don't have in front of you, but you will know what I'm talking about. I'm interested in the trash collection services that you all use. It's a separate contract from what the county uses.
What's your page, Julie?
Oh. It's probably B1.
Which appendix?
B.
A and B.
You've got a lot of contracts. It's on pages B1 and B2.
Right.
And I know you have several for photocopier maintenance and several for marketing, but it's the trash removal that I'm curious about. The airport has a separate contract. It doesn't piggyback on the county's trash removal contract.
The answer to your question, the generic answer to your question is we are taking a look at all of the expenditures, contract and otherwise, that we have with an eye to working with county services whenever possible. And I can give you an example. We do quite a bit of landscape work. I don't mean pretty landscape. I mean ditches and roads and what have you. And we're interested in trying to work more closely with the highway department. So you're going to see in 2015 iterations, as we're able to find more efficient ways to do things than we may have done them in the past, we'll bring them forward to you and we'll make those changes.
So the answer is you're not using the counties right now.
We are. We use the county contract as well. Lisa goes out, gets the quotes, for all of us, but we're an enterprise fund, so we have to list it because we pay it separately than the one county bill that, like, facilities would get.
Okay.
We pay NYSEG separately, so all of ours are paid from our funds.
That's why I brought Roxanne along, because I was thinking about the...
Thank you for clearing that up, Roxanne. Julie, are you finished?
I have a question on Appendix C. That's the memberships one. And I noticed that the airport pays... money, an increased amount of money to TCAD. And since both the airport and TCAD are having financial trouble, I don't understand why the airport's increasing its amount.
That was something that had come out, you know, each year they send out requesting more money. And that was something that was just approved by Bob, I would guess, each year, you know, after meeting with TCAD.
Is that $250?
Well, it's a principle that I'm curious about.
Oh, I see.
About.
Okay.
It's not the amount. It's what it portends for our history and future.
I understand. I didn't realize we were doing principles tonight.
Do you have any insight on that?
On the increase? No, I wasn't.
Why the airport pays to TCAD an increased amount?
No, I think they adjusted their membership dues probably for all their members, including the airport.
Well, okay. With respect to your OTR, $125,000 plus, could you tell me, one of you, the details of what adds up to make that? Where does that come from? Is it county attorney? Is it who is it?
Roxanne may have the details. I don't. But generally it's for all those overhead services that they would have to buy on their own if they were a standalone. So
which ones are they? Do you know, Roxanne?
Everything from county attorney to personnel to purchasing to finance to payroll.
Yep.
Across the board.
And it's an annual payment. It's like paying dues for the services rather than accepting invoices for by the hour.
So we would see this reflected in a decrease in income for each of the departments you're talking about. Is that the way it works?
I think it comes into the budget. Kevin, refresh me. I think it comes into the budget as a single charge, maybe as an unallocated revenue. Is that where we saw that revenue?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so it doesn't hit each of the individual departments. It hits our bottom line.
Thank you.
Mike Flynn.
Mike, I really like all your thoughts here about different ways of approaching these things. Many airports get revenue that helps in addition to facilities charges. They may have space that they lease and other things. I know we do some of that. Some of the land up at the airport we've looked at for the possibility of a shovel-ready site up there. And I know TCAD, when they came in and spoke to us the other night, they talked about the need for looking at shovel-ready sites. Wondered if that's something we should, in your mind, we ought to be exploring.
I think we absolutely should be exploring it. There are some energy options that have been, associated by name with the airport. I had a meeting the other day with Tom Lavigne from Cornell Real Estate, just a preliminary to say, hey, let's sit down and have lunch someday and talk about our respective interests. We're not in the real estate development business. TCAD is to some degree. I mean, there are partners in this community that could work with us. And believe me, Sikorsky may have left town in Elmira taking the jobs, but they're still paying the rent on those buildings, which is really helping the Elmira Airport. And if we have land that can be developed consistent with the sustainable master plan and the other goals of our community, and it passes muster with the legislature, I think we should be doing that.
Thank you.
Lastly, Peter Stein.
The thing that you said that depressed me the most, if I understood it right, hopefully I didn't understand it right, is that the airport industry is now starting to think about larger airplanes as being the minimum number of passengers that they can fly, because that can just drive us out of business. That, you know, there's a limit as to how many passengers that we can serve. We can't fill a 600-seat airplane from Ithaca traffic. And if that happens, that sounds like the death knell to flights from Ithaca.
Well, we can't allow that to happen, sir. And if we get back to the 2010 level of emplanements, we could have the same level of service, the same percentage of load factor with 70-seat airplanes as we do today with 50. So it's an achievable goal, but it's one that we really have to work hard to get to, because you're right, if one 70-seat airplane replaces two flights that had a lower load factor, you're in a death spiral, no question about it. But there's not much we can do about it.
Right,
you know,
no.
We're not training enough pilots, so they can't find enough pilots to fly the airplanes. That's one of the reasons they want larger airplanes. Everybody, when you take off and land with two engines on the back, the more people are in the airplane, the happier they are. We're just in one of those parts of the cycle. At some point, somebody's going to get a bright idea and build a really nifty, 50-seat airplane that people would like to fly, and they'll come back. But for right now, the progression is very clearly toward larger airplanes, and the 70-seater is going to be the new standard.
I have another question, which really doesn't have much to do with us, but has always fascinated me, and maybe you can answer it. I'm not a real frequent flyer, but I fly periodically, and I go search for at the various sites that there are. And one thing that has always amazed me is the disparity of the ticket price from the cheapest to the most expensive.
Right.
Like huge factors.
Yep.
And every time I see that, I say, how can this work? Who's paying those prices that they're charging for the airplanes at the expensive end of the cycle?
Why
are they doing that?
Let me tell you how well it works. For 100 years of airline industry, there is no profit to be shown. So it doesn't really work but it's the way they try to maximize revenue on the airplane. That's all I can tell you. I can't say that I think it's a good way of doing business or anything else, but they throw some seats out there cheap early on, and then, you know, the prices go up the closer you get to flying. And you're right, there's no economic rationale for the disparity in prices. Simply, that's just the way the industry operates. And that's one of the reasons six are becoming three, because six couldn't figure out how to make a business out of it. Tough situation.
Well,
way back when you were making the presentation, you referenced some device that was went out periodically, and you used a technical term that I didn't know.
The ILS?
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's an instrument landing system that allows you to land in bad weather.
Okay.
And we have one of them in Ithaca. And when it goes down and the weather's bad, we've knocked off air service. We have to be much more proactive with forcing the FAA to come up and do maintenance and look for, you know, for options so that that doesn't happen to us. I just wanted to make the point that it's not all the airlines. I'm not trying to tar them with a brush. It's us, too. We need to do a better job as an airport, being an advocate and making sure that our systems are reliable. And so we're putting a lot of effort into that area. And that brings you back to people. We have tremendous professionals at the airport. Those 15 FTEs are some of the finest people that you can find in our community. Our crash fire rescue people are all EMS qualified, and almost to a person, they volunteer in fire departments back in their home community, and they're really great people. And we need to leverage them to help people develop a greater comfort for the Ithaca-Tompkins Regional Airport.
Okay. My second question, as you were describing how we are doing vis-a-vis our nearest competitors, I would assume that every one of those airports is dealing with the movement toward larger planes. Is that an industry?
Yeah.
And they may, a place like Syracuse may be able to better fill those planes or whatever. But am I right that the another factor in terms of the Elmira's success was the boom from the fracking industry?
Yeah. Elmira is a boom-bust town, and they had a boom when everybody came into Pennsylvania, and then they had a bust and everybody left and went to Western Pennsylvania. And now they're getting a little bit of a boom again because people are starting to come back. That's as the relative price of natural gas and some of the quality issues associated with gas. So, you know, Elmira has always been a town where the economy was a real sine wave. Ithaca, on the other hand, because of Cornell University, is nice and steady. And we have to leverage that. I will tell you that Corning Incorporated has a contract with Delta Airlines operating out of the Elmira Corning Regional Airport. We need to encourage Cornell, difficult as it is, to consider the same kind of arrangement. That would give us some real purchasing power and maybe the ability to influence fares in a more understandable way than Mr. Stein described.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, we've had Delta meet with Cornell, and there's some interest. You know, it just, you know what it's like. Cornell's like herding cats, and every department is independent. And so getting central travel to make a deal with an airline is a pretty big lift. But it's something we've got to try.
Good. Thank you.
Yep. Loveland.
That's a real simple question. Do airlines our size usually have more than one ILS?
We should have had two, but it's too late. The instrument landing system is on its way out. It's being replaced by satellite-based global positioning, or GPS. We would never get a second ILS at this point before GPS becomes the standard of approaches. The airlines are just beginning to be equipped with GPS. But we should have had a second ILS years ago, but we didn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Get it.
Thank you, Michael and Roxanne. The thing that impresses me most about what I heard this evening is that we're down 25% in the last 3 years, and this legislature, I believe, has to do everything possible it can in the future to turn that tide around. So thank you very much for your information and your presentation. And we will see you again, I'm sure.
Well, thank you for your time this evening, and absolutely, we will consult you at every step of the way as this unfolds as a strategy.
Thank you.
Legislators, I'm going to make a change to the schedule, and I've asked the Deborah Prado from Personnel to present. And she was scheduled to be last, and I want to move her to number two. She has a long ride ahead of her after this meeting and until she relocates here in Tompkins. So, Deb, you're up, and Jackie Thomas. Go ahead.
Good evening. Thanks for taking me out of order. That really helps me a lot. I don't have probably as nearly as an exciting presentation as General Hall does, but nonetheless very important as structural department in terms of the employees and your human capital asset in terms of Tompkins County. So how do I advance this?
Down arrow.
All right. Pretty self-explanatory. We're going from 826 to 878. 51,646 is a change, 6.25%. That reflects a change in two personnel positions, staffing positions, Anita Fitzpatrick's position, which I'm now in, and then a request for 50.5 FTE of a position that we asked for last year, entry-level position to start some of our succession planning. Change in full-time equivalents to 0.50, which is the addition of the other half-time of Quinn Godfrey's position, the information aide. Is that in there twice?
That's our OTR.
Oh, and that's our OTR. Try to gloss right over that. For our over target, it's 16,611, and that represents the 0.5 TE for the information aid position. So the information aid position is pretty important for our department. I have seven folks right now, Quinn would be the eight at 7.5 and eight, and I have 50% of my team who have informed me they are planning, not just thinking about, but planning to retire in the next 4 years. There's a pretty steep learning curve in terms of all of the civil service regulations and rules and bureaucracy that we have to work through. And Quinn's position, the information aide, we created it. It's non-competitive, so no testing. Our hope is that Quinn will come in, stay the 2 years, ramp up in her position, then start to take competitive level positions as we transition through some other positions. That gives her a good basis, a good foundation for learning the department, and then we'll be able to kind of rinse and repeat, bring that back through with some other positions. The benefit of non-competitive is we can pick who we'd like to join our department, and we're not limited by the civil service rule of three. So that's really important for us in terms of finding some teammates that can really come in and grab the reins. Our major influencers really are, and this is a double-edged sword, the online application system has steadily increased applications, translating to additional civil service examination responsibilities and costs. But at the same time, it's exactly what we wanted it to do. We have more and more applicants applying for our examination, which strengthens our candidate pool, which strengthens our ability to find great employees for our future. Our over target is what I said before. It directly relates to our succession planning. I'm looking at the big picture. I'm looking at core competencies for the folks that have informed me they're planning on retiring. What am I going to need for the future? How do I build a great team to capitalize on our talent pipeline and our human capital investment that we have right now? Succession planning, although it's talked about, sometimes it's hard to do, but I do believe that you fail to plan, you have plan to fail. And as far as new folks in our department, we've got some generational between early 20s and early 60s, and the interplay between great ideas and the infusion of new ideas and asking why do we do this and can we do it differently has been a tremendous asset for my team. Our goals for this coming year is continue to roll out the electronic document capture system so that all of the employee files are captured electronically. We're going paperless. To document our processes and procedures, that's an important baseline as we go into succession planning, but also for time and efficiency. We need to eliminate some redundancies, how many times folks touch one piece of paper, reduce our cycle times, and we need to focus on meeting or exceeding our customer requirements. So you'll see me moving in the next year, year and a half, to develop service level agreements with my customer departments on what their expectations are of my team and how and when we'll meet those. The diversity and inclusion policy, as I see personnel as taking the lead there with WDIC, when you read through that, we really need to grab the reins and be a leader. We need to build on the framework that's there, develop some tactics, some milestones and some measurements so we can report into you how we're progressing along. And we will continue to expand our outreach with school districts, TC3, and the community. Those are outreach conversations, opportunities, where we're telling folks about the types of positions that we have here, the types of employment, and just generally industry-wide, if you're interested in being a nurse, we have opportunities in different areas that you might not have thought of. If you're interested in criminal justice, there are other things to be involved with, not only through police officer. So those are the kind of things that we're working to establish a relationship and be seen as an employer of choice. With that, I will take any questions.
I have Brian first. Anyone else? Please raise your hand. Dan, after. Go ahead, Brian.
Thanks, Deb. You mentioned the web-based applications. I can see where that would result in increased applications, increased workloads, especially when it comes time for setting up for examinations, all that kind of stuff. This is kind of a two-part question. Are you finding that, I mean, it's very simple to get on the internet and sprinkle the infield and, you know, and apply for everything under the sun. You're assuming that they're going to show up for examinations, and you've got to prepare for that. My first part of my question is, are you finding where that's occurring and people aren't showing up? And if so, have we thought about charging a fee to apply for a job? I know the city of Ithaca did do that. I haven't kept up with it. And it may be something as simple as, you know, and you can have a waiver procedure or something for somebody that just cannot afford to do it. And it can be refundable if they show up for the examination like they're supposed to. But otherwise they forfeit that fee because they may not have had any intentions of ever showing up. You know, they're just sitting at their keyboard applying for everything.
So answer to the first part of the question, I don't know that we've had a greater rate of no-shows as we get more applications through. I do know that it is easier for us than the old paper base to flip through and qualify folks. So sure. On the good side, that moves a little. I think we've taken some steps to remedy that by taking some of the former New York State examinations and administering them in-house. So that lessens some of those fees and booklets and all the things that we pay for. I asked the same question about why don't we charge a fee nearly every other. I think we're the only county that doesn't in New York State charge a fee. And right now the answer is, and I agree with it, you know, why add another barrier? There's already a lot of paper. When you talk about collecting fees and waivers, you almost have a new full-time job collecting fees, bouncing checks, all those kind of things. So until it becomes one of the huge obstacles for us to get over, it's probably not so high on my priority list. But, I do wonder sometimes if that would be enough of a revenue source that would really help us out, or whether it would just be something that creates another hurdle for someone to get over and they say never mind. And as we look to get as wide of a candidate pool as we can, it makes sense to me right now to keep it as is.
Okay. Dan.
Hi, I wanted to ask you about the term customer requirements up there in your goals.
Yes.
Who do you consider your customers?
I consider all of the operating departments and other staff departments to be my customer. When I look at the relationship I have with the law department, with the finance department, we're a direct link. We're late on something. Payroll's late on something. Mike and I have been working very closely together on a lot of the operational issues that are out there. In terms of when he talked about, changing the job description for the crash, fire, rescue, and the weather observation that goes down, we're talking about changing job specifications and whether that results in a reclass or whether it doesn't. And so my timely response to his operational needs is paramount to success.
Deb, may I ask you a question? Tell me how your first few weeks have been here in joining this August group.
It's been great. It really has. Everyone has been super welcoming. I've learned a lot. The departments that I've met with, have gone through and done tours, met some of the faces and names. I'm doing pretty good on names and faces and operational requirements. Really, my basis in Monroe County, so the job titles are familiar when you say public health sanitarian. I don't get this funny notion in my head what that might be. I know that that's the civil service title that's existed for forever, and I know what those kind of folks do, but it's been great.
Thank you. Leslin.
Do we, or Jackie, do we administer the civil service test for anyone else other than county?
We actually administer all of the civil service requirements for all of the towns, villages, school districts, with the exception of the Ithaca City School District and the City of Ithaca. So when we give an exam, those eligible lists are used by all of those entities.
Okay. And then, thank you. And then maybe this question is for Joe or Kevin. I'm looking at the budget page on 264. And there are some big numbers. Oh, like travel and training, what's included in that? It's in 2013, it was 57, and I remember we did something different that brought it up to 82. Could you please remind me?
I'll try to get my chronology down. I'll look to Jackie and Deb to make sure I'm correct. You recall that we made a major commitment to training a few years ago. We said we're going to invest in technology and training. So some of the growth that you see there reflects that commitment by the legislature to invest in training. That account houses, call it, at least three buckets of training. Our smart work commitment, is smart work in there, or is that in a different line?
That's in a different line.
Okay.
Jackie, please use your mic. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Where's smart work?
Smart work is actually in our professional services line.
Thank you. That answers that question.
We have approximately $28,000.
Thank you. Okay.
I think the rest of it is the rest of it all the increased amount that we had put in for general county or general training for proficiency and career development.
Yes.
So it's ongoing training. We'd always provided a certain amount of training. We increased that a couple of years ago to be able to do more career development and proficiency work, and I think that's the growth that you see in that account. I don't know if there's anything else going on in there or not, Jackie.
No, that's correct.
Yes, a follow-up on that. Now, departments have their own training line, so this isn't a line the departments, for want of a better term, apply to if they want to do a special training. This is for the training series that personnel will put out, sort of thing, right?
Actually, this is a conglomerate of the Supervising for Success training. It's also the TC3 online training that's available to all county employees with the permission, with the approval of their supervisors. And there is some you know, small amounts that are left that departments can apply for, or if we have individuals that would like to attend specific trainings that pertain to their specific jobs or certifications that we use it for.
I guess the last thing I would add is that when the increase was made a couple of years ago, we assembled a training committee to figure out how to best apply that money. And Deb and I have talked about it's probably time to reassemble a training committee to see if that's still where we're getting the biggest impact for our dollar. So I think that's something that's on the agenda for the next few months.
You know me too well that you're anticipating my questions and answering them. Jim, I'm sorry. May I just go back and ask a follow-up on the civil service question? So, Jackie, if I understand you right, I am the town of Ulysses, and I have a job opening that civil service. Do I contact you all to say I need an exam ordered and administered?
Actually, it's simpler than that. You would be able to log into our online application system. You would be able to check to see if there's an eligible list. Mm-hmm. And if there is, you could either ask us to canvass the list for you, or you would be able to contact you would ask us to certify the list for you. And we would be able to do that automatically without the telephone calls or letters. Mm-hmm. At which time, as soon as it's certified, we send you an email. You're able to log in and look at all of the applications and be able to determine who it is that you would like to interview and ultimately to hire. If there is no eligible list, you can then fill out a form online in the same system and request that we post a vacancy for you, and we'll post it. We will review all of your applications, and you can review the applications online in real time as we're approving them. And you can do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from any location that has internet access.
All right, let me be clear that I'm not advocating for this. But do the municipalities and school districts for whom we do this work, do we get any remuneration from them for that?
No, we're required by civil service law that we provide the service.
We are the civil service entity.
Yes.
Thank you.
Kalchak.
So I know this would never be a major part of our budget, but I do notice that on the revenues side over the last number of years, it's always zero, zero, zero. Are there ever any opportunities out there? Should we want to put ourselves on the cutting edge of training programs or outreach? Would there be money out there we could?
I would
once
say
that's
part
in?
Of the discussion on training, on whether we start to charge a minimal amount for seats. I think right now we've taken a cost-neutral approach to fill up a classroom so that we, you know, get some economies of scale with a presenter's costs. But there could be a time in the future that I would envision we would have some subject matter experts as trainers, and we would start to put on our own trainings and charge something for them. Typically, it's not a huge revenue profit center for personnel, but there are small opportunities I think we could explore.
And then your answer to Dan's question about who do you see as your clients? Was finance and who else did you say?
Any one of the other departments that we have contact with, and because, you know, we deal with the human capital, it's just about every department that has an employee.
So for me as an employee, if I were looking to see where in the budget is serving me as an employee, where would I look?
If you were
not necessarily yours, but maybe this is a question for Joe as well.
Well, I don't think I think you're suggesting that personnel isn't responsive to individual employees. And I think they are. I mean, I think among the stakeholders and customers and clients that personnel is dealing with are individual employees who want to know about employee benefits, about programs, about where they can redress grievances and those kinds of things. So that certainly is funneled through the personnel office.
Okay, so it's there, but not, it's partly, it would be in each individual department.
whether
and it's
the department is an
employees.
Advocate. And
it's applicants. Okay. It's who might be interested in knowing a little bit more about the civil service process, what exams are coming up. They walk in, you know, what's available to them. So we deal with spouses. We deal with retirees. There's just about everybody who would be interested in employment is somebody that we end up talking to.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Julie.
Thank you, Jim. I'm back on page 264 where Leslin left us and looking at the utilities budget line, which goes down a third, and I'm wondering how you're saving so much on utilities. That's telephone, isn't
it? It went from 1,500 to 1,000.
I didn't say it was big bucks. It's a trend which is intriguing to me.
It's the telephone, and a lot of that has to do with some of our online.
Telephone. Okay, thank you. And there was one other question there.
You know, it's an electronic world.
I'm looking at page 269, where the programs are summarized, and under each program, there's a number representing FTEs for each program. And when I add them up on the right-hand side for 2015, I get 8 people, but you have fewer than 8 FTEs on the other page. So I'm curious.
I'm going to let Jackie explain this because this has to do with Anita's position.
Okay.
So for the past couple of years, we have not had Anita's position budgeted at a full-time position. She's always been that 0.77 portion. Mm-hmm. When Deb was hired this year, that 0.77 position was brought back up to a full-time position. And when we did all the budget documents, that was prior to hiring anyone. So that is...
So it's just on page 265, it's an error then?
Yes.
Okay, so, that's fine.
Yeah, and I've made a note to get that corrected.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Thank you both very much, Deb, for coming in at this point. Tompkins County Public Library, and it is Chapter 5, page 71 in the big book, and they have OTRs 50 through 54. They had 5 requests, 4 were covered, 1 was not. Good evening, Susan.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, always, as always, for the opportunity to talk with you tonight. I love having an opportunity to share with you information about the library, and it's an opportunity not only to present the budget, but it's an opportunity to thank you and to share with you how we've utilized the funding over the year. And I also like to point out what we bring to the community since we are the county library. So first of all, I'd like to thank you for the resolution that you passed earlier this year in celebration of our 150 years of service to the county. These are a few photos from that celebration in April. It's a photo of our county historians program, a photo of our chair of the county legislature, the New York State librarian, state legislators, the president of our board of trustees, and then with any good celebration, there's always cake. The important thing is that 150 years ago, Ezra Cornell recognized that the people of Tompkins County needed and deserved a free public library. This is a man who understood that an organization that ensures equal access to everyone in the community benefits the entire community. And he left a gift which has been used by individuals at every age and every stage of their lives for 150 years. He left an amazing library. So even more astonishing is that in the year and a half since founding the library, the people of the community still need and deserve that place. So I'd like to also follow up on the recommendations from last year. We took very seriously the recommendations from the County Library Budget Working Group, that was the report that was issued in 2013. And I'll talk about the first two right now in the next slide, and the last one I'd like to talk about a little bit later. One of the major recommendations was for the Board of Trustees to embark upon a community engagement process. To that end, a blue ribbon panel of community leaders met for a discussion about the library. There were four meetings over the course of this year. This photo, the photos are from the very first meeting this past May. This was a small panel with participants who provided support, leadership, and strategic problem solving. Our goal for this group is that they will help us gain community support as we broaden the community engagement and help us identify and discuss options for a more sustainable funding option. The panel's role has been to provide the Board of Trustees with input as the board maps out a strategy for ensuring the library's sound future. And we plan to broaden the community engagement. I'm excited about that because we'll be having more community focus groups with our collaborators, with the public, with businesses, in order to find out, you know, what is the importance of the library to them and what can the library be doing better and what ideas do they have for the library's future. Additionally, in the library, we made some significant organizational changes. We ensured that all of our departments have a New York State certified librarian as department head. With no funding for additional staff, we undertook a significant rebalancing of our staff positions, the existing staff positions, in order to have staff placed as efficiently and effectively as possible. This was a pretty major restructuring, but it allowed us to do our due diligence in reviewing all vacant positions, and in fact, all positions in the library. The library has not replaced staff unless absolutely necessary. And by restructuring and more efficiently utilizing staff funds, by year end, we will actually have 42.1 FTE. However, I will note that in January 2009, before I started, the library was at 49.37 FTE. So it's important to know that we've had to incorporate extra work into our daily operations as the Finger Lakes Library System has had decreased state funding. And there are some programs that are really important that they have eliminated, such as the Mail-It program. And this is a very specific program for shut-ins and people who are not able to travel. And we have been investigating how we might take that on as we're hearing from our community that that's important to them. So the fiscal target is the one that is recommended by the county administration. We are following the recommendations from last year. We're not asking for ongoing funding increases. We are drawing down our fund balance as recommended in order to balance our budget. The decrease in revenues is due to the fact that we will receive $10,000 less from the town of Ithaca. And as this is a point in time, our foundation revenue does not show up till the end of the year, so I'm hoping that that 4.2% in decreased revenues will be less than that by the year end as the foundation continues to raise money. The fund balance for the prior year is really the carryover from 2013. That was money that was to meet outstanding obligations for collection orders, equipment, and so forth, and we will have to look at that again this year. We try to save as much as we can to offset outstanding and encumbered funds that we will have at the end of the year. In 2014, you can see that we drew down our fund balance to balance our budget, and in 2015, we'll be drawing down additional amounts. This, again, if you remember the working group report, these are the recommended amounts, and the recommended amount for the fund balance to be left is between $70,000 and $50,000, and we're looking at that. But I believe I have a responsibility to you and to the community to demonstrate the value. The library absolutely contributes to the well-being of the community. It's a social safety net. We provide free and open access to information, technology, reading and learning, personal growth, and community connections. The library is an anchor institution downtown. We provide help with health care information, which has been a big thing this year, the new Affordable Care Act. We provide equal and unbiased access to essential technology, increasingly online-only information and Internet connectivity. And we continue to see a full range of people, those who have very little understanding of how to set up an email account, to those who have much more sophisticated needs. In fact, I am quite often asked when we are going to have some kind of a lab where people might be able to do some of their own work, such as creating their websites for their businesses or managing their online photos. And that's a big goal we have, is to have a digital literacy lab for a 21st century library. The one thing that's for sure is that as the world of technology tools change, the request for help from the library is very consistent. I also think it's important to share with you how the library is used, because you're a primary funder. The statistics on the screen demonstrate that the library is heavily used by the community. In 2013 alone, there were over 1.1 million online connections. And this is the count comes from the website, the social media, the catalog, every way that people connect with us online. It's very important these days. People tend to think of the library use as in-person only, but it's both. It's online and in-person. Over 870,000 physical items were used from the collection, and we have nearly 40,000 registered borrowers. We have, on average, almost 500,000 visitors per year. We have, at this point, 41.3 FTE staff, and we have an incredible group of volunteers. Once again, I think when I first started, the legislature had just approved a full-time volunteer coordinator. We have leveraged that position unbelievably, and we basically every year have about 4.5 FTE worth of volunteer help throughout the library. So the numbers here represent the quantity of a busy library, but it's the quality of the individual engaging learning experience that people have in the library, and our role is a community anchor that makes us outstanding. Our library is a place for people when it's freezing outside, and during the summer when there are heat warnings, the library is offered as a cool place to go. And I hope that each time you have an opportunity to visit the library, that you take a minute to notice the experience of the people who are in the building. It's a very powerful thing for me every single day. Sustainability is a big word these days, and libraries are among the original organizations supporting sustainability. We buy something once, and it's used thousands of times. Each year, we calculate the return on investment in the library, and we do this by actually looking at what is the actual cost of a hardback book, a paperback book, and so on. And then we look at our annual statistics, and we calculate how much the community has saved by using the library. Using your local library is one of the best examples of a green initiative. For every dollar that we receive from the county, we provide $7 worth of service to the community. And for every total dollar, we provide $5 worth of service. Good return on investment. And that study room use an hour, that's more than 10,000 hours of use for those study rooms each year. So I want to go back to that, the recommendations from the working group report. And the recommendations were to undertake a community engagement process. And we know about the people who love and use the library, but we decided that we needed to find out more about, throughout the county, what people really thought about the library. So we worked with the Cornell University Survey Research Institute to conduct a telephone survey throughout the county. The survey was based on a survey that was done by the Pew Internet and American Life Project. They published a report of a study that they had done about public libraries, and we used that as a model. And the purpose of this was we wanted to provide our Blue Ribbon panel with some information about the community perception, but we also thought that you would like to know as well. And I certainly wanted to know what is the perception of the library and how can we build on it. So one of the things we wanted to know is if people in the community are familiar with how the library is funded. And, of course, we learned that over 80% knew very little or nothing about how the library is funded. But these are some important statistics. I think the third one is one that is interesting to me, that 76% of the people surveyed really liked talking to a real person. And that was one of the things we learned. So we will utilize these survey results as we broaden that community engagement and have our focus groups and other meetings. We also have a poll on our website and social media, so we're reaching out to as many of our community members as we can to get feedback on the library. So the over-target requests supported by the budget, very appreciative. The first one is for a telephone system. The telephone system we have is the original telephone system, and it has malfunctioned three or four times in the last 6 months. We've had no telephone service, which is a safety issue, of course, and an inconvenience for people trying to utilize library services. There was one day when the system kind of had a mind of its own, and if you called and you wanted my extension, you might get the circulation desk. It seemed to randomly assign telephone calls. There's no more, we've learned from the company that the replacement parts are fast disappearing, so we appreciate this recommendation very much. The second one is our security gate, which is also the original 3M security gate from 2000. And there's very much ongoing difficulty, and the new head librarian, who's the head of the Circulation and Access Services Department, did a pretty extensive study of what was happening, because I had noticed for quite a number of years that this alarm seemed to go off constantly, which is not what should be happening. The gate alarms more when more than one person goes through at the same time and randomly, when no items seem to be, when no items are in anybody's bags. And she actually did a study that the from January through June 2014, there were almost 5,000 alarms, or roughly almost 30 alarms a day. As a librarian who's been around for a long time, that's a lot. Something's not right. So one of the things we found is that people are not very happy when they're stopped at the gate, and of course there's no reason for them being stopped. So we really appreciate this recommendation for this OTR. The other two recommendations have to do with our online system, making sure that our system is not taken out of commission during a power outage, which would mean that people would not be able to access the website or the online catalog, and having a firewall as well. I mean, today I got 20 spam messages for used cars, so I'm looking forward to getting this. The over-target request that's not supported is we had looked at the possibility for an electronic time card system. But we understand the reasons for this is not recommended, and we're fine with that. So in closing, I wanted to share this card with you. I wanted to thank you for all that you do for the county and for supporting the library. But this photo is from the art exhibit in honor of the 150th anniversary of the chartering of the library. We invited the community to create cards for a very old-fashioned, traditional card catalog, and this exhibit was called Diary of a Library. So this has 27 zeros, and I actually did research to find out what number is this, and there isn't one. So I basically have been saying that, you know, he wants the library to be around for a gazillion years. And I think it's important that this young patron recognize the service of the library. But I think that this sums up the hopes and wishes for the community, for the library, that it's around for a very long time. And I know that Ezra Cornell couldn't have envisioned technology and the changes in how people read and publishing, but he couldn't have imagined all the devices, all our smartphones that we're using and the iPads. But he did know that no matter what lay ahead, a community with a healthy library is a better community for all. And so I really appreciate the recommended budget and the recommended OTRs. And thank you for an opportunity to speak with you. I'd also like to thank the members of the Friends of the Library, the foundation directors, and the trustees who came to support me. Thank you.
Questions for Susan. Will, Mike Dooley, Peter.
Thank you. Susan, once again, I'm totally impressed by all you folks to do, and I hope you continue to thrive and get the resources, and I wish we could be giving you more. I would like to hear a little more about, I know that you have a structural funding issue that I got as part of the goal of the Blue Ribbon panel. Mm-hmm. I,
I wasn't clear from what you're saying in terms of where that seems to be heading and what time frame. Can you speak a little more about that, please?
In the working group report, the recommendation was that the legislature help the library for 2014 and 2015, and there was a recommendation that the Board of Trustees connect with the community to educate the community about the library and to gather feedback about to educate them about the funding and to solicit ideas about how do we make the library sustainable, the funding model. So we've been collecting all of this feedback, connecting with the Blue Ribbon Panel, connecting through the community engagement, but the Board of Trustees will have to, in 2015, have some discussions about requests and recommendations to the legislature and the county administrator about what we do about funding going forward. So the process is that we had some time to educate the community and try to generate ideas either about revenue or another type of sustainable funding model. There's always the dreaded referendum word that comes up for discussion, and that's certainly part of the discussion.
Okay. And my second question, I know Finger Lakes is moving out. Where does that stand, and what is the thinking in terms of the use of that space?
The Finger Lakes is moving out. They purchased a building that they're renovating up by Tree Forms, by NYSEG up there. And their goal is to be there in early 2015. In 2008, there was a space analysis study done of TCPL with a recommendation for how that space would be used. The plan had always been that once Finger Lakes left, the library would have that space. So we have been looking at the space, and we have some extremely important priorities for the community. We need a teen center most desperately. We certainly can see that on a daily basis, what's happening in town. There's a real need for that, a place that's not the school, it's not home. It is a place where they can come and just be. They're not graded on anything. So I feel very passionate about the teen center. I could talk about that a long time, so I'll stop with that. The other thing is a 21st century skills lab. We really need that. So we're looking at space that's being vacated by Finger Lakes for that. And we're hopeful that we have been working with an architect for some conceptual designs, and we're hoping to do fundraising for that.
Okay, thank you.
Mike Lane.
Hi, Susan. I'm certainly glad to hear you mention the friends and the volunteers and the foundation. It's a county library, but without them, we wouldn't have the quality of service we're able to offer to the people of the county. What I'm concerned about is the issue I know you've been concerned about as well, of the some of the population in the area outside of the library. It's, as we know, the major bus stop in the city. We know they have a lot of folks that have moved over from the commons area because of changes in regulations of the commons, including the smoking ban. Have you noticed that improving or not improving? Is that something that that we need to think about how we're going to address?
Thank you for asking. I appreciated the questions about that last year as well. It is such a complicated situation because we are the library and we welcome everyone. And we have had some challenging situations. It has improved lately. One of the things that we did is, you know, we realized that these are members of our community, and we invited them earlier this year. We went outside and actually invited some of the members of the groups that were hanging out to come in and talk with us about what they needed from the library, how could the library help them. We have reached out to almost every organization in the county, mental health, who's been tremendously helpful, family and children's, all of those groups. It was really interesting when we met with some of the members of this population. They were actually, you know, library lovers, and we got a really great volunteer. You know, one of the best volunteers we've ever had was part of that population and is trying to turn his life around. We have seen some real challenging behavior, and we work really closely with law enforcement. And the mayor put together a group of community organizations and invited us to talk about how could we have an outreach team based on something like the Burlington model. And there's a task force, and we have someone who's participating in that. That said, I will say that there was a point earlier this year where we did actually have to make some arrests and press charges for some of the things that were happening in the library. Once we made some arrests, press charges, the most egregious behavior stopped. So it's complicated because there are people who want to smoke. There are people who just want to hang out. And if you can't come to a library and do that, but there are people who are extremely disruptive and they're disrespectful of other people's trying to use the library. And I hear about it a lot from the community. So it's a work in progress, and we'll continue to work on that. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so. I think it's important. Do we see evidence of substance abuse problems in that area?
Yes, that's the arrests that were made. We were 5 cases of very direct substance abuse in the library that were witnessed by, we have great guards, and we had to call the police.
Thank you.
Dooley Kiefer.
Thank you. I understand from your presentation that this is a holding year, sort of treading water, but it has for a long time been clear to me that more staff would be appropriate, and I think at the end of the dialogue with the community that will still be the case. And I couldn't find today when I looked for it some of the background material that you had given us in years past, which detailed the specialties that you need in different staff and numbers. So I wouldn't make use of it in this budget season. I will respect the process that's unfolding, but I would really like that information again sometime.
Absolutely.
Whenever it's convenient. There's something on page 573, but I don't know what it is, so let me find it.
Well, while you're looking, I'll say that the staff of the library, as we went through this restructuring and reorganization, have really pulled together. They have worked very creatively and collaboratively, and they are offering even more services than I thought possible to the community. They're incredibly dedicated. They're maxed out.
Well, I'm not finding what I looked for, but the question was why there's yet further decrease in staff. Did I misread something somewhere?
Well, we were able to, we didn't receive any funding for additional staff. Well, what we did was find it internally. So we are at 41.3 right now, and we will be at 40, or I think we're 41.8. I'd have to look back at the number, but we will go up slightly by more efficiently using our funds. But that will be it. We'll be at the end of our funds.
All right. Well, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it is a decrease because before I started, they were over 49 FTE.
Peter Stein.
I had a bunch of questions, but they've been answered by, they've been raised by other people. But I have a piece of information which you may want to hear. The 27 zeros that you wrote down on that paper. You said it had no name.
Did you find it?
Yes, it does have a name.
Oh, great.
It's a billion billion. A billion billion has got 27 zeros.
All right. Well, I have to find you and write that down. That sounds impressive.
Anyone else for Susan? Thank you very much,
Thank
Susan.
You. Thank you very much.
And all the people that came to the meeting connected with the library. Thank you for your time. Up next is the county attorney, and it is chapter 4, page 44, and there's one OTR, and it was covered in the administrator's budget.
Does that mean I don't have to cover it?
No, please do. You know, we're, no one gets off the hook.
Okay. Well, never sat in this spot before. Just a couple thoughts. I mean, you all know pretty much what the county attorney's office does. And we serve other departments for the most part. And you know, we've been busy. We give advice. We do litigation, personnel matters, family court. And there's no reason to think that that's going to change or lessen over the next several years. We don't really initiate a whole lot. The one thing that we've been initiating recently and expect to continue over the next couple of years is some renewable energy projects, one of which was announced this week. But for the most part, we're reliant on other departments. But litigation and personnel matters and those things do not seem to be on the wane. They seem to be, if anything, increasing. And so we have to do, if anything, more with less. Second thought I have on the county attorney's office is that over time we've seen a lot of departments or programs that the county does, for example, the hospital, the CHA, landfills, and things which become less and less economic for the county to do and more for the private sector to do. And with the county attorney's office, it's kind of the opposite. It's becoming more and more economic for us to do it, given that lawyers outside of us are charging $250 an hour. So keeping our own department strong is just an economic benefit to the county because the alternative is very expensive. And then I had an observation on the budget. That when I looked at the numbers of the budget and I was trying to figure what percent of that budget is our is personnel, and you would never guess this, but the percentage of our total budget that's personnel is 107%, which would seem impossible. And the reason why is because the percentage of our expenses is 97.6, but we also have a little revenue. So we actually, the amount that we spend on personnel actually exceeds the budget, which I'm sure is not true of any other department, or I would be very surprised if that was true of any other department. So if we can go to the top full-time equivalents has not changed. At one point we had four, but that was several years ago, and it's probably been at least maybe 7 or 8 years where we've had 3.5. And, you know, my view was at the time, if people who are here recall, that it was better to keep 3.5 good people and to keep the basically the money we spend than trying to spread it out and have people who really weren't qualified to do the work. But that hasn't changed, and I don't expect it to change, but it's been that way for probably 8 years or so. The over-target request is basically just to keep, when it says update law books, that's basically what you do with law books. You don't get new ones. You just keep updating them. So that's just how it works. And Westlaw is the legal research online service that we use. And those prices go up over time. They're a basic minimum requirement to run a law office. You have to be able to research the law, and that's pretty much And that's not going to change over time. It's not going to become less. Our office, like most offices, like most law offices, if you went into a law office years ago, you would see all those books, all those case law books. And now our office and other offices don't do that. You keep a minimum amount of books and use whatever online you can. But there's still some books that you need to get. So it's really at a bare minimum. It's much fewer books than we used to get. And it's really at a bare minimum. But you have to be able to have the minimum research facilities and tools to do your job.
Questions for Jonathan? Carol Chalk.
Hi, Jonathan. You referred at the beginning to the grant that was announced this week, and people may not all know about that, and I urge you to tell us about it, but also I'm assuming that you're talking about the joint city-county solar. The question has to do with there were 94 projects announced, a total of $142 million, something like that, of which Tompkins County is listed as having received six, or two projects within Tompkins County, but nowhere could I find what the other, well, I found one of the other five is referred to, but the other four aren't. And you don't have to answer it today, but maybe by Tuesday you could see if you can find out who the others were.
Sure. I can tell you that Mega got 24. Including ours, which is, they haven't figured out all the numbers, but it's a huge number. Because the governor is actually they're the ones who, you don't want to say the value of the project is different than what they figure the value of the project. I can tell you the value of the Tompkins County project. I assume most of you have seen the ad, or I mean the press release and maybe the thing in the paper and others, but the value of the Tompkins County is, I believe, $6.7 million, which is actually what the cost of putting up the 10 acres of the solar is, of the solar panels. The actual amount of the grant is $902,000 for the Tompkins County one, which is spread over 2 years. And that, along with the other credits and accelerated depreciation and the payments that the company gets from the city make it an economic project to do. The county itself actually gets half per kilowatt hour, which amounts to, it's going to be about $14,000 a year, and we have to charge because the FAA requires, because it's airport property. So it benefits the county. And the way the city pays for it is it's an addition to their per kilowatt hour fee that they pay to the company.
Well, thank you.
Anyone else?
Maybe you could put that in writing and distribute it to us or in an email.
Anyone else?
Okay, I'll do that.
Dooley.
Thank you. On page 4-44, which is your budget page, there's an intra-fund transfer in revenue of $25,000. Could you tell me where that comes from?
Yeah, that's solid waste. And one of the significant things about the solid waste, paying a portion of my salary, is that it comes out of the solid waste fee instead of out of the tax.
Right. I'm looking on page 289. Is that right? That can't be right. It must be 448. That's the program summary page where your two programs are County Attorney's Office and Family Court work done by you all. And their FTEs listed for each of those two programs. And they add to 3.38, but you have 3.5 people in your office. So I just wonder if you could tell me
I think that should probably be corrected, because I think the difference is when one of the people went from half of 35, 17 and a half, to half of 40. So it's 2.5 hours, and I think it just wasn't reflected in there.
Thank you.
Sure.
Anyone else? Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Up next is Tompkins Community Action, Chapter 5, page 54, OTR 49. Which was a partial fund by the county administrator in his budget.
Good evening.
Evening.
I want to introduce our Deputy Director, Carrie Berman, who's also our CFO, is joining us tonight, answer any questions. So, Tompkins Community Action, we are, am I doing it right here, right? Good, okay. So, this is our base funding. Certainly appreciate the change. Our focus tonight will be on our over-target requests, which I'm sure that you're curious about. We wanted to provide you some facts about the poverty rate in Tompkins County. Families of three in New York paying almost 58% of their income. New York is number two in the top 10 least affordable states for center-based infant toddler care. You probably have read or have been, you've seen a lot of the information about increases in learning and in pre-K, but without the benefit of pre-K, children not arriving at school, ready for school, and that continues through the fourth grade. We're celebrating a lot of things this year. We celebrated 50 years of community action. We're celebrating 50 years of Head Start. And that's us. Early Head Start serves infants and toddlers, provides two-thirds of daily nutrition. I have given you our annual report for 2014. And some more statistics about poverty in our county. I'm not going to go through the annual report, but for Head Start, we serve a lot of food in Head Start. And I think Carrie can attest to we're the children are hungry. They're hungrier. We started serving almost a dinner at lunchtime instead of a lunch because the kids are very hungry. Our over target is for the programs at the Casey Center. Casey Center we also gave you some pictures of the Casey Center. The first picture is the renovation. We have been, we purchased the building, I think, 2012. We rented it from the Stevens family for many years before that, probably 2005. We had the opportunity to rent the TC3 farmhouse. I don't know if when you go into the TC3, you'll see a little farmhouse that's on the right-hand side. We were there for over 40 years providing Head Start services to families and children in Dryden. We needed to move out of that property. And we, over the summer, expanded our Casey site, which is across from the elementary school in Dryden, for with three more classrooms, a commercial kitchen, a space for meeting community activities and parent literacy. So what we're asking for is we're asking for $50,000 for two classrooms. We give you a little bit about need. It's difficult to find infant and toddler care in Tompkins County. There's only one other licensed infant and toddler care in Dryden, and that's at TC3. We have had preliminary conversations with TC3 about partnering. They've just gotten a new early childhood person there, and so I'm hoping that we're going to be working with TC3 soon. But in the meantime, we hired and Schickel Construction, who did an incredible job of getting 4,000 square feet added to a building in 2 months. So if you take a look at the pictures, it's a beautiful space, great light, wonderful classrooms. What we would like to do is we would like to add 2 additional classrooms serving 20 families. Carrie, you want to talk a little bit about the funding?
Sure. Carrie, please use the microphone.
Sure. Head Start's federal funding has been the same model for since its inception for 50 years. In order for us to get federal funding, we need to have 25% local match. And so our current funding of $3.4 million, we have to generate 25% what they call non-federal share in-kind and funds. So if we can secure $50,000 worth of funding, we can leverage another $150,000 worth of funding. That will provide for 6 full-time positions, fringe, consumables for 2 classrooms, the operational costs of 2 classrooms, and that's 50 weeks of programming for 20 families, because Head Start is much more than just infant and child care. It's a family, whole family program. We have family partners that are working with families in their homes on goals they have, helping people move out of poverty. We have ongoing training and tuition funding that is available for families. You know, certainly last year with the cuts in food stamps, our families were hit really hard. We've implemented a food nutrition program. We have 4 events a month that include parents and their children, and this includes a dinner. And for one of these programs that we're running called Eating the Harvest, families are coming and cooking, having a meal with their children and staff, and they leave with another full meal for their family. And all of this is funded with Head Start dollars. So it's a lot more than just the daily 5 days a week child care that also enables families to work. You know, right now, without doing any recruiting, we have 20 applications from families that are at between 100 and 130% of poverty, with children 1 or 2 years old that would like to have their children in a center. Of those 20 applications, 12 of them would be eligible for child care vouchers, which is an annual cost for outlay for DSS benefits of a bit over $11,000 a year. So those are 12 families right off the bat who aren't going to be needing child care vouchers from the county because Head Start is free. Is there anything else I can detail for you about budget or?
Are you through, Lee? We'll do questions at the end. Go through your whole. You're finished?
Okay. Yeah, I think so. I think that the over target would support 2 classrooms. I wanted to add that we are a living wage provider. we see a great need in Dryden, and we've been able to, through private funding, create a wonderful space for families and their children.
I had Peter Stein and Mike, but my question, what's your total annual budget?
Let's see. In I think this year it's going to be around $6 million.
Okay.
We got about 100 staff.
All right. I had Peter, and who was the other person who had their hand up? Go ahead, Peter, Carol, and Brian.
You said something that I found really surprising, and that was that Head Start is a whole lot more than giving children a head start in schools. And what you described sounded to me like Head Start was sort of like any other income enhancement for people that didn't have enough income. I mean, I didn't realize that Head Start was not solely focused on the problem of poor children that don't have the background necessary for school. So I would think, you know, if you do a lot of things that you don't have all the money devoted to that particular problem. I don't know if I'm stating that properly, but that sort of confused me there.
Well, Head Start is a family services program. And I think that's one of the reasons, for example, that it has always remained at the federal level under Health and Human Services, as opposed to sitting in the Department of Education, because it is about the whole family. And there is an expectation, and we are required to create program goals and report outcomes to the federal government of how we are working with families to help them meet their individual goals, as well as helping families move out of poverty. For example, one of the mandates in Head Start is if you have any open position and a current or former Head Start parent has the credentials, you're mandated to hire them, because it's considered to be an anti-poverty program. You're supposed to be helping these families as a unit move out of poverty, not just prepare their children to succeed in education, which we all know helps keep people out of poverty.
And another statistic that we're especially proud of is that 24% of our current Head Start staff were previous Head Start parents.
Okay.
You know, I think I had Mike was second, and then Carol, and then Brian. So, Mike, if you want to go ahead.
I'm just trying to understand this. In Dryden, you built a beautiful addition, by the way. I had a chance to see in there, and it is beautiful, which is three classrooms, I think you said. And yet we're talking two classrooms here. Are they different classrooms, or are they part of this? Two classrooms of these three, or I don't understand what's happening here.
So the facility now has a total of five classrooms.
Right.
It had two that were Head Start classrooms. We built an addition, creating three classrooms. So in essence, we moved those two Head Start classrooms into the new addition. We moved our Head Start classroom from the farmhouse there. So those were three existing funded classrooms in our grant. So now we have two new classrooms that we have designed and laid out to meet the requirements for early Head Start, which has a little larger space requirements, different sort of equipment requirements to serve that age group. The ratios are different. So now we're trying to expand our funding to include those two early Head Start classrooms.
All right, so this is sort of like an amendment to this grant to add two more rooms, classrooms.
That's right, correct. Yeah. If you look at your pictures, they're the blue and the yellow rooms. When we first started renting the Casey Center, was 29 Union Street, it was called then, we tried one large classroom in that area. It's the blue part of the white building is the existing part. And we tried having a large Head Start 3 to 5 year old classroom. It was really noisy. So then we thought, well, let's make two of it, and it got even noisier. So now we've got this large room. We've included an extra exit. There was only one exit, so that was always a problem, having two classrooms, having one exit. So now we have two exits, and it's perfect for the smaller rooms that infants and toddlers require licensing-wise. We'd only have 10 in a room.
The other thing that the addition does for our families is what we were able to achieve in Groton when we did the addition there, where we also have five classrooms. And that's that children and their families are enrolled in the center anywhere from 3 to 5 years. So literally a family can come to Casey Center with their one-year-old and stay in that center, going to school, moving room to room until they're ready for kindergarten, which is across the street in the Dryden Elementary School. So it's an opportunity for, you know, what is called continuity of care and building long-term relationships. And so we wanted to replicate that model in Dryden. So we wanted to be able to serve one-year-olds and two-year-olds and three-year-olds and four-year-olds. So you need classrooms to do that.
The Dryden Elementary School is thrilled that we've done this, and we run a UPK, Universal Pre-K classroom in the Dryden School. We do transition activities. The little kids look out and see the big kids getting on the bus. Transition activities when they're ready to graduate from Head Start into the school. They already know where their classroom's going to be. They already know who their teacher's going to be, and so do the parents. So it's a really nice, nice continuity there.
Carol.
How many children do we serve in Head Start or families throughout the county?
350.
Okay. And then,
children and their families.
And is it a full-day program or part-day program?
It's considered a full-day program. It's between 6 and 6.5 hours, depending on the site.
Okay. And then,
so the classroom is then open for a half hour before, and usually, you know, up to an hour after. But actual designated programming is between 6 and 6.5 hours, depending on the site.
Okay. And then if we get the federal money, does that come with a commitment for a certain number of years of operating support?
As long as we can demonstrate that we can meet the 25%, what they call non-federal share, this will become a permanent part of our program. So we will, instead of serving 350 families, we will be serving 370 families.
So you'll have to continue. This is all operating money. It's not construction of the facility?
No, it's wages and fringe, consumables, which is, you know, the stuff that, and then operations, the cost of space, utilities, maintenance.
The construction's all done and financed.
And that was all private sector dollars. None of that was federal funding.
Okay.
Brian, and then Julia, then Will.
I'll start with just a comment. You know, anytime you can leverage local dollars at 300%, seems to be a pretty good deal. My question is, well, I got two questions. How do you get a fringe rate that low? That's one. And it has been recommended, I think, at 25.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your fallback with regards to that?
I'll let Carrie talk about the fringe, but if we get 25, we'll do one classroom. If we get 50, we'll do two. Pretty simple. Yeah.
Okay.
And the fringe?
Is that just health care?
No. That's
I'm just curious because ours is about 55.
Well, that's major medical, that's dental, it's unemployment, it's disability, it's our the employer's payroll tax contribution, and it's retirement. I think our health care and our dental is certainly competitive. I don't know the county's plan, but I'm certainly in the private sector. You know, we have a major medical, Blue Cross Blue Shield, a comprehensive plan. What we don't have is the kind of retirement plan that I know that the county has. So we don't have a strong, robust retirement plan. It's 25 cents on a dollar. It's the best that we can do. And so that's what our rate is. The Health Care Act was of benefit to our organization. We had a number of staff whose children went into the marketplace and they were able to get coverage for them for nothing. That threshold for coverage for children is quite high. So that in turn created a savings for us. And we certainly meet all the requirements. We pay 78% of individual coverage cost for health and dental.
Thank you.
Dooley.
Thanks. I'm looking at the budget page 5-54. It's called consolidated budget, and I don't know what that term means. What is consolidated there?
That's your turn.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is.
So, Dooley, that in this case, it doesn't make immediate sense. For departments or agencies that have multiple functional units within them, it represents a consolidation of those into one summary budget.
Well, as I turn the pages in our budget, there are an amazing list of different programs there. But I think they would all add up to more than what's on this page here. So are those programs not county supported? Those are just...
That's right. They're not county supported.
So I think Jim might have started this out by asking what your total budget is. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out what those pages are that detail all the programs and what that adds up to. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure it's $6 million, so I am confused about the information that's in our budget book. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just enough that I say that. I think for agencies like yours, it's always interesting for us to see what percentage of your total budget we actually supply. And it's pretty small in this instance.
Mm-hmm.
So in your annual report that you gave us, will I find your full budget?
Yes.
Okay. I will look at that and stop
talking
about this.
Certainly, you know, I can contact you tomorrow or next week, and we can talk, you know, we can meet and talk about it. It's complicated.
I was just trying to make sense of what was in our budget book.
Yeah.
And was having trouble. So thank you. I like your idea very much.
I have, Will. Incidentally, it's $6 million, and we're $6 million you stated, and we're 200,000 of that $6 million, right?
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, I think we get. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Will, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. I would second that. I second Dooley's sense that it's useful for us to know how we fit into the larger puzzle. And I was looking at the annual report, and I can see the figures for 2013. Is your current budget for 14 roughly the same, or is it?
I think we'll be around six. I can't remember what it was last.
Yeah,
it's less. It's going to be less. You know, this is 2013 in the beginning of 2014, of course, we had sequestration.
Okay. Yeah.
Fortunately for us, the largest impact of sequestration was in our Head Start, early Head Start budget, because that's, you know, $3.4 million of our revenue. And all of those dollars were reinstated in the last continuing resolution because...
Unfortunately, not the case in all our programs.
Okay. So my other question is sort of broader. In your early slide, you reminded us that the poverty rate in Thompson County is about 20%. I'm always astounded when I learned, like, Ithaca is more like 45%.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we think of this as a very affluent community, but in fact, many, many people are hurting.
Yeah.
You've been around for 50 years, $6 million. Your goal is to move people, not just, you know, keep them steady, but to move them out of poverty. And I'm just trying to get a better sense of to what extent you've been successful in actually transitioning and, you know.
I wish we had numbers on that, but computer programs didn't exist long enough for us to know that. I've been around. I just celebrated my 29th anniversary there. I don't know if I celebrated it, but I just kind of wondered what in the world happened to 29 years. But I have seen so many families using Head Start, using Section 8 vouchers, getting into recovery services, either staying in this community and becoming nurses or teachers. I think we've been very successful. I'm afraid I can't give you, 70% of the people that we've met are out of poverty. I don't have that. I wish I did. But it's combining these employment supports. We just opened Magnolia House. That's almost full. People being able to keep their children, getting supports in housing, it just has made a world of difference in hundreds of people's lives.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much. Up next is TCAT, and I noticed Joe is here, and we're on Chapter 5, page 64, and there is no OTR request. Welcome back, Joe. Hope you're doing well.
It's good to be back. It's the first time I've been in this room, and it's a very nice room. I feel like I'm in the Smithsonian. So what we want to focus on tonight, back in July, TCAT presented their annual draft operating capital budgets, and you can see up on the spreadsheet on the left side in July. That's what was presented. And after that presentation and listening to everyone and having many internal meetings at TCAP, we came up with some different ideas. And when you go on the August revisions, you can see that we've made some changes. So I always look at the big numbers. You can see in July we were talking about service cuts. We were talking about a hiring freeze. Neither one of those were popular at all. You can imagine our riders losing their service at a time our ridership is at an all-time high. And also internally at TCAT, staff is extremely lean and oftentimes spending many hours in the office past the time we're all supposed to be there. So we realized those are two major stresses, and we started trying to figure out, well, what can we do about it? And you can see on the green shaded column, the big number that's sticking out there is the increased CU fares. I'm sure in the presentation it came across, as did all our ridership over the last so many years, ridership went up. Ridership went up on Cornell as well. And we were getting paid for those rides at a $2.6 million amount consistently, but the ridership was going up, so the per-ride fare, in a sense, was going down. So we looked at that, and we, through a board resolution, voted unanimously by the board, we simply asked for an increase to help us with our budget. There was a lot more to the resolution, but I'm just summarizing that. And what that did as a result, thankfully for TCAT, President Skorton was willing to meet with us. A meeting was set up. Coincidentally, the meeting took place this morning. So four of our board members met with four of Dr. Skorton, President Skorton's leadership team, and from all accounts from the meeting was a very positive outcome. There was two parts to it that TCAT went into. Obviously, the first one was getting our dollar a ride concept back up to a dollar a ride. And secondly, probably more importantly, was to start discussions on an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, so we can finally have a document that both Cornell and TCAT can use every year, so we're not having this discussion every year. And I can say from the outcome of the meeting, TCAT was successful on both fronts. The details of that are not released at this time until such time our TCAT board gets back together and talks about what the outcome of this morning was. So we're optimistic that our revision we placed in August we can go forward with. And I can't say this enough, this is a draft budget at this time, and we actually hopefully will adopt our final budget in December. The other part of the story here is that I'm sure you all know it was the seventh year in a row TCAT came to our funding entities with a zero increase. So the $829,000 is what we've asked for 7 years in a row, and I think that's an amazing feat that we've been able to do that and keep our service level at the level we're at, and all the while increasing our ridership tremendously. So that's the short story tonight. I think this really summarizes where we are today pretty accurately. And I'm wide open to any questions. I got to warn everybody, I'm a little bit rusty. I've been out a little bit, so I'll do my best to answer your questions.
Questions for both of the gentlemen in the back of the room. Dooley Bryan.
Thank you. I was extremely depressed at the July presentation, because you have not been in a position for some reason to ask the partners to increase their contributions. And as time passes, things just get worse and worse. I'm very encouraged to hear what you said about the Cornell MOU and a certain price per ride as a policy, but it doesn't deal with what I've came away from the July meeting really worried about. And at that meeting, toward the end, I made a request/suggestion that the TCAT board or staff, whoever does these things, come back to us all with a five-year plan, or maybe if it would take longer, a longer period of time plan, that would get you on a firm footing instead of going downhill as each year goes by. So I guess my question is, did that message ever get conveyed to you? Is there a chance that will be acted on this year so that we could see what you will need over some period of years so that we wouldn't get hit with an increase in 1 year, but over time we would have, as Joe always here says, a glide path to where we need to get?
Well, I do know at TCAT we've had a five-year both operating capital projection. We're always looking out. The one thing we're not talking, I didn't talk about it all tonight, was our capital budget. It's very, very concerning. We know that. But we also know the success of that program is going to be greatly dependent upon federal grant monies. We have to get grants. We can't expect Tompkins County, City of Ithaca, Cornell University to come up with $8 million for buses. It's not going to happen. So the push going forward really needs to be capital grant funding, and what that will also do for our operating budget, being able to use the mortgage recording tax when we need to in our operating budget. But it's very hard to do that today, knowing the capital budget is in such, is so underfunded. We're being very protective of the MRT at the same time. So, answer your question, I know there's five-year plans at TCAP for operating and capital, and more than happy to share those with you.
Well, what you did share at the meeting we did see in July did not look like a workable five-year plan. That's what's worrying me. And I wish you could come back to the partners with a recognition that we can't just keep making flat contributions.
Okay. Brian.
Thanks. And good to see you, Joe.
Thank you.
My question, you've touched on it a little bit. What is the actual the mortgage recording tax? What has that realized since it's been in existence? I know there was a lot of back and forth amongst this body with some of the stuff you're touching upon, whether it's operating expense or dedicated capital fund and that sort of stuff. I take it most of that has to go at this point to operating costs. But what are those figures? Have they met projections?
We only received the first one in March. We're going to receive the next one this month, hopefully.
October.
Thank you. Okay. So I don't know the figure yet until we receive it.
Okay. Anyone else? Peter and Brian, are you finished?
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter Stein.
Not a question. It's a statement.
Okay.
If that's all right with you, if not, I won't do it.
I don't know what you're going to say, so I'm not certain.
Well, I'm trying to answer the question that Dooley raised, okay?
Oh, give it a shot.
From the point of view as a county legislator and as a member of the TCAT board.
Go ahead.
We have no operating plan for 5 years. You can write down numbers on a paper, but it doesn't look very good. We can't figure out how to do it. There's a general agreement that we can't increase the partner share because, in particular, it's doubtful that the city would be willing to increase it, and we can't increase it by ourselves. And it's doubtful, I think, that Cornell would increase it. Maybe we could talk the county into increasing it, but I don't believe we can talk the other two partners into it. We have not solved the capital problem. And in addition to that, we have not solved the operating problem. So we have a lot of problems. And I think I agree with you. I don't think we can walk away from it. We have to face it. It's my belief, and now I can speak only for myself and not the rest of TCAT, is that what we have used as a measure of our success is actually a measure of our failure. Namely, that rides go up every single time we look. Every year, the rides get more than before. And we think of that as an accomplishment of TCAD, because after all, we're a bus company, and what a bus company is supposed to do is to transport people. On the other hand, the more people you transport, the more it costs you, it saves you, and the people, by their fares, whether or not at the into the fare box or paid by Cornell, do not pay for the entire operation. And we're now facing a more and more stingy state government and federal government, which is where the majority of our support has come from in the past. So that's the situation we're in, and it's not easy. I happen to believe that we have to really figure out how to serve the community with the same number of rides on the bus, and that we can't look at increasing rides on the bus as being a good outcome. So that's my point of view.
Well, are you responding to Peter?
I certainly am, because I, Peter.
Well, then let's not get too far in the weeds.
No,
okay?
but I want to take it to a positive thing. I mean, it is both, Peter. It's both a problem and a measure of success. It is ultimately a critical service to our community, and every person who takes a bus is not taking a car. So, you know, it is good. We just have to figure a way to pay for it. And I have to, and maybe this is going back to Joe, I have to assume that we are not the only transit system that's struggling, and that you know, all over the country, people are dealing with the stingy governments. And are you seeing any other strategy out there of how people are dealing with this? Or?
Well, I think the challenge in Tompkins County is that we're running a big city system. We're running a much greater system comparable to populations of a million and greater. And where we sit on the federal funding side, they look at us and say, well, you should probably have about 10 buses because your population is X. And I think that's the anomaly that's going on that hurts us on the operating budget. The federal government is more of a population-based funding mechanism. If they recognized our system, we would receive much more, much greater funding. And I always use the example with Binghamton, Broome County, same exact size systems, and they get double what we get from the federal government, which is over $1 million more. And I think that's got to be the push going forward when we're trying to figure out how to get more federal dollars, is tell that story. We have a 50-bus system in Little Tompkins County, New York, and we're wildly successful. We have 4.1 million rides, and that's almost half of what Central does up in Syracuse, almost half. And their budget, last time I looked, was $35 million. So it is an anomaly, and I think that's some of the pain we have is that one funding source.
Okay. And I've been trying to make sense of this sort of sheet, of which is the revisions to your budget and whatever. Give me the headline and what we need to understand from all of that, the most important thing that in terms of...
I just, like I started out to say, I think service cuts are off the table.
Right.
The hiring freeze, we have three positions we really need to fill, and we're hopeful that to make up for that, that the Cornell fares on the volume discount program will overcome those two.
So the it's a hope. If Cornell comes through, we're okay. Otherwise,
right.
There's no plan B.
I think it's greater than a hope at this point, but I'm not at liberty to say.
Okay,
you know.
All right. I hope you're right. Thank you.
Mike Fine.
In August, we heard that we have a possibility of having a hydrogen-fueled bus coming. I wondered if we get that, how and where will we fuel it?
Well, part of the project is on-site. We'll have a hydrogen filling station where the hydrogen fuel cell bus will be fueled on-site. That's part of the project.
That's part of the project.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Anyone else? What I heard here, and I hope that we all recognize this, that
The discussion at the meeting that took place this morning, it's extremely confidential, and I would hope that we all recognize that. And, well, but, you know, it's out there.
I think it'll be announced in tomorrow's newspaper.
All right. Well, you know, whatever. Thank you both. Appreciate it very much. County Administration.
Jim, can
nice
I just
to
ask
see you
one
here,
other
Joe.
Thing? So will we get another presentation once there's new numbers?
I don't know that it would be necessary, but maybe. I don't know. What's going to change? Revenue.
Once we know something more about what the...
Revenue. Deficit. Right? I mean, that's a one-liner.
Excuse me, Jim. I don't think they're asking for any funding change as far as we're concerned.
No. No.
Okay.
County Administration. Theirs goes from Chapter 1 to Chapter 5 and any pages.
Boy, it looks different from this end of the table, doesn't it? I think I'm your last. I'm your last department in this whole process. And if we go as long as we did the other night, I figure I've got an hour to get through my stuff. So I'm sure you'll be patient as I do this. Our budget is as usual very straightforward. There's actually been a reduction of almost 6% in the budget, net local, compared to 2014. That's something of an anomaly. If you recall last year, the legislature gave us some extra money, one-time money, to be able to bring Kevin McGuire in, although it wasn't known to be Kevin McGuire at that time, so that we had a period of overlap between Kevin Sutherland and a replacement, so it eased the transition. So that one-time money inflated the 2014 budget a bit, and that's really why we're down more than that 1% for 2015. In terms of FTEs, the half position that's down in county administration is the one I just talked about. It was that one-time half-time position. It was to be funded for half of the year, so that comes out of the budget for this year. The second element of this reflects the fact that over the past year we brought Stop DWI into our operation. The STOP program has been kind of nomadic over its existence. At one time it was in the planning department. At one time it was in administration. At one time it was in the DA. It stopped. It was in the sheriff's office for a while. By charter, it reports directly to me. I think that's what was anticipated in the charter. So this year we brought STOP over to our operation, and the office is operating out of county administration now. So in our numbers, you see those numbers brought into our budget lines. In terms of OTRs, there are two. The first is, I think it's really important. It's a part of our renewed commitment to the Limited English Proficiency, or LEP, program. This is something that WDIC has been very strong about. We do have certain obligations under federal law to make sure that if people come to us and they want to be able to talk about services and they don't have a proficiency in English, we are obligated to provide them with assistance, both in translation and interpretation. Frankly, we'd like to go beyond the minimum requirements of federal law, and if anybody comes in and wants to be able to communicate with us or to do business with us, to walk into a meeting, that we should be able to provide some help for them. What we found in looking at the way we provide the service right now is we do it. So if we're required to do it, we do it. But it's a very fragmented department-by-department approach. So we're trying to develop a centralized approach, including a central contract with professional services to provide translation and interpretation. We think that the price will be better, but we also think the quality will be better. Everybody will buy off a single county contract. So it establishes this line item in our budget so the departments can basically use that contract and buy against that contract. So that's number one. Number two is simply to provide enough money, which we didn't have under the 1% cut, to do a three-year computer replacement program. Both of the requests are for target funding. I found my request to be clear and compelling, and I've recommended that we fund them in this budget. So those are the two OTRs that are in there. And that's basically the Department of Administration budget. Now, when we finish this, I'd like to highlight some of the stray accounts that are in the budget that often we don't talk about, but that are out there, like the contingent fund and so forth, and go through a couple of those. And then I also have a brief section on the capital program that I can go through.
Question for Joe about the CA budget.
Joe, can you?
Julie?
Thank you. I am mystified about DWI. I heard what you said. But I was looking at, I think it's B, Appendix B, where you contract now with Alcohol and Drug Council, local police agencies. I don't understand how they were in your budget, then they went away, then now they're back again. What's going on?
Right. For readability, we've brought all of those into our budget. So even though STOP was in the DA's budget a couple of years ago, so these would have shown up in the DA's budget, we brought them forward into our budget so you can see kind of what the history of activity has been in those STOP DWI contracts. There are a couple of years, I think it's the middle years, I'm not looking at the sheet right now, I think it's the middle years where they may show zero. I think that's less that there weren't contracts and more that those contracts weren't shown in the budget document as it was presented to us and the legislature. So we're basically picking that up now that it's over in our budget.
So are you still paying for a half-time DA employee?
We're paying for a DA employee who offers some assistance to Michelle. She picks up the cases once they're over in the DA's office. We're also paying for 30% of the investigator in the DA's office who assists with the collection of stop fines and fees, which are pretty significant. So those two crosswalks over to the DA's budget exist still, as they did when the program was over there.
Do we have an opportunity to talk you out of this and have it put somewhere else?
It's a fait accompli. We've moved it over to our shop. And, Dooley, I think when you look at things, it is in the right place now. It's where it was envisioned to begin with. We can provide support staff to the operation. We can provide some management oversight to the operation. We aren't at risk of any law enforcement agency suggesting that we may have a bias about where the money goes based on where the operation sits. So as we looked at it, objectively, I think there are really good reasons for it to be where it is now.
Did you I don't remember you discussing this at government operations.
No, I don't know that we did at government operations. You know, there's been communication with Brian through public safety, but it was just kind of an internal shift.
Well, you can tell I'm not content with it, and I won't pursue that anymore tonight. But
right, if I can add one, it is absolutely budget neutral. There is no effect on the budget at all. The bottom line is net neutral.
That's nice.
Anyone else? I'm sorry. I have
you. You mean?
Go ahead, Leslie.
I'm looking at your staffing, and I'm trying to figure out who is who here. The executive assistant to county administrator.
Right. That's Kevin.
That's Kevin. And. So
I can go down them if you like.
Just the administrative services coordinator.
It's Andrea Gibbs.
That's Andrea.
Contracts is Jackie.
Thank you. No, I couldn't figure out what the difference was. So the program analyst is what's no longer here.
Correct.
Where is the stop DWI coordinator?
Next page.
I don't see a coordinator. What role? What title is that?
Victim advocate slash
That's
recovery
who that
specialist.
Is. Okay.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else?
And this is a statement question, Jim.
Sure.
Thank you, Joe, for the over-target request for the LEP program.
our plan. I have requested that that plan be sent to all of you as legislators and with a resolution to follow for adoption of it. And my question is, you all are going to vote for it, right? It's coming. But I do appreciate this being in the budget.
Anything else? All right. Dan Carroll Dooley.
I wanted to ask you about the administrative policy manual.
Sure.
Halftime position. Can you talk about that?
Well, it's not a halftime position. It's the allocation of the equivalent of a half FTE to work on that. Much of that work is done by Paula Younger. I think you know she's the one who really coordinates that work for us. So when we try to allocate, and these are imperfect measures, and we've tried to make that point before, but when we try to allocate how we spend our time, it comes up to about a half of an FTE, and much of that half is Paula's time.
I'm just, the word manual is kind of interesting there. I mean, that implies producing a document. That's not what...
Frankly, no, it's not a book, although it's the 21st century manual. So if you look online, it's organized as a policy manual with sections and references and so forth. So that's kind of what we would consider our policy manual. It's that online piece that you can see on our page.
And you feel like it's roughly a halftime position changing the manual, like half the time?
So that's 1,000 hours. And I think it probably is. We're not only committed, Dan, to new policies. You've had a couple recently. The breach, the acceptable use. But also there was a commitment made to the legislature years ago to periodically revisit and update the older policies. So it's an ongoing effort. And I think you've seen it's a pretty time-consuming process.
Carol.
Joe, I don't know how you do everything that you do. I see that you have a line still carried over for a secretary for the office. Is that just a carryover, or
I think that's a relic.
Are you keeping it there on purpose because you actually need one?
No, in fact, I have a very good person. Andrea Gibbs is the administrative services coordinator, so she really serves that function, does scheduling and support and so forth for the office. So the title is really a relic, a legacy title. There's no plan to fill that. It's just it's there to show kind of the history of the titles in the office.
Thanks.
Back to you, Dula.
Yeah, I wish you would ask us for more staff. I think it's clear that you need more, but I know you'd like to set a good example to other departments, right. And I'm not sure that's going to be wise to keep that up. The page 4-42, there's something called public information media.
Yeah.
There's some expense, but there's nobody doing it.
Right.
What is that?
It's the contract with Cooperative Extension for Jim Blizzard and those services that we receive for here.
Okay. It just wasn't clear to me.
Yep.
Your utilities costs in different programs, sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down. Earlier, when I asked that question, it was telephone that had gone down. But in your county administrator utilities line, it's gone up. So what does that mean? That's page.
You know, Dooley, I'd have to figure out how we allocated those costs. I will, but I just don't know offhand.
It's gone up for risk management too. It's a funny line. Okay.
Hold on, Kevin may have a response.
It looks like it went down to me.
Depends where you look.
2014 modified is 2,300, and the target 2015 is 1,760.
Some of the adjustments have been to true things up with where our actuals have fallen, and it appears in my work on the office budget that there was a time when it was phone charges were allocated to each of our individual sort of functional units, and that maybe they were consolidated, and there's needed to be some truing up to actuals, and I think that accounts for some of the movement there.
Okay. I'm very conscious of energy use, and utilities includes both,
sure,
I guess, telephone and energy. So I'm always checking that line. Thank you. I will stop.
Move on.
Anyone else?
Okay.
Stop using an electric heater in the office.
I'll go quickly, and you can slow me down when you'd like to talk about something. We didn't highlight everything, but there are certain items in the budget that we often kind of skip by. We don't call them out, and sometimes they can be rather large, so we've tried to do a little bit of that this year. The contingent fund is a large account. It's money that we set aside because things happen. We use it to a large extent to cover terminal pay and things like that, but again, over the course of the year, things do happen that you want some money to have. Last year, you recall that we increased it by around $100,000. We've talked a lot about how that had kind of a loose fence around it for living wage things. So what's reflected here is what we're doing for 2015, which is to reduce that contingency only by the amount that we've transferred out into the departments, including the OTR, to support living wage adjustments. So that's the adjustment there, and that money is really just moved to mental health and to COFA. The mental health one is dependent upon you approving that that OTR for mental health. It's recommended in the budget, but you still need to approve it. The insurance reserve, we don't talk about this one very much. A couple of years ago, when it was almost depleted, we did, because we needed to rebuild it. We are still in a rebuilding stage. This is probably $125,000 more than we used to budget in the past, but we are still in a rebuilding phase. I know that the county attorney briefed the legislature a couple of months ago about some risks that are out there that we need to make sure that we're covered for. So this will allow us to do this. So we've sustained the level of funding for the insurance reserve. I would hope that within a reasonable period of time, that one can start coming down a bit as we build things up to where they should be.
Jim, I wondered how large the insurance reserve is.
You know, I scribbled it down before I left, and then I forgot the paper. Do you recall?
Yeah, I double-checked that with Jackie Kipola today, and it's projected at the end of this year to be about $1.5 million, and at the end of 2014, I believe about $1.6 million.
Thank you.
Quick question, Mike. Thank you.
Sales tax is the big one. I mean, sales tax is really important because whatever we can realize in sales tax growth is money that we don't have to levy in the property tax. And you can see where we are going with this. We have projected growth of 2% this year over that number on the far left, which is the 2003 actual, and then backed it down a little bit for 1.5% in 2015. We think this is prudent. At this level, we think it's attainable, but prudent. In making those assumptions, it drives about $784,000 of new sales tax revenue into this budget compared to what we had budgeted last year.
Wait, so I have a question about that one.
All right.
Okay. So for each. The difference in that 0.5%, first of all, when will we have the third quarter funds? What's it been? What's the growth rate been over the past 5 years? And for each percent, how much money is it?
About 300,000 for each 1%.
Per 1%. And then what has it been over the last 5 years? And
yeah, I would have to get that trend data, which I can. We can get the growth factor for you. You may recall Rick reporting on where we are with sales tax. So the first half of the year, we're up around 4%. So it's robust growth. But you also recall in the first quarter, we were flat. And then we had a big second quarter. And it's so volatile right now that it really concerns us, I think, if we were to get too aggressive with the sales tax during this period of extreme ups and downs. I just worry that we'll fall short, and if we fall short, then there are some pretty extreme consequences that will go with it. So, again, I feel like this is a good, prudent, and attainable level of revenue. But
but for each. So, but if we were to assume 1.6 or 1.7%, we could easily.
Yeah. Like for every 1%, it's 300,000. For every 1/10 of a percent, it's 30,000. Right.
Thank you.
Another large one, and we've adjusted it. The only reason we called this one out is because we adjusted it this year. The budget's been set at $300,000 for a long time for outside colleges. These are the college chargebacks that other counties charge us because our residents go to school at their community colleges. And we've seen a pretty significant increase in the actual amount that we spend for chargebacks. So we felt that it would be appropriate, necessary, for us to adjust the number up to $390,000. This year, and we ran awfully close to that. I can't recall. Do you have the 2013 actual? But again, we're seeing the growth trend, and this is, we've heard this statewide. Everybody is talking about how chargebacks are rising. So rather than leave ourselves short, we've adjusted it to $390,000.
Mike?
Joe, isn't it true that some counties actually take those chargebacks and make their towns and villages and cities pay those charges
rather than do it themselves.
So I think this is isn't this another example of where, like election expenses and other things, that the county is helping the other municipalities out?
Shared services.
I'm going to move on here. The other one is old news. But it does have an effect on our budget, so we put it up here. The TC3 3% increase is an $83,000 item in this budget, $83,000 growth. So those are some of the larger ones that we've called out. I can't read it from here. What is it?
The actual on the 2013 actuals for the college chargebacks was $385,000.
So if you're okay with that, I'm going to proceed to the capital plan. This is a very high-level overview of what's in your budget. The budget is pretty complete. The budget has a summary of what the debt service costs are projected to be over the next few years. It has a five-year capital program that lays out, and I'll show you some slides too, what the projects are that are envisioned over the next 5 years. And there's also the PAR forms, the forms that we typically use to watch over our capital projects that are a part of the budget document. And even behind that, I know Dooley often asks for, there is a more comprehensive version of the PAR form. If anybody wants that, we can provide that too. It just doesn't fit neatly into the budget, so we've done as much as we can. So in looking at over the next 5 years, and again, this is all in the document, there are several programs that are familiar to you. They add up to about $5.75 million. A couple of them, a good example is the one second line, the 911 telephone system. We're showing the $598 here because that's what it will cost to buy this system. But what we're not showing here is that most, maybe all of that cost is going to be covered in grants. So by the time it hits the county budget and what we have to borrow, that could be a vastly reduced number. But when you add up all the things that we expect that we will be doing in 2015, you can see that it's $5.75 million. Comes down a bit in 2016. Here are the big projects. There's a couple of them. The Mallaryville Road project would come back to you in 2016 for construction. Planning of that is underway. Those projects would come back to you for consideration before they go forward. So just because we're saying them here and putting them on a slide doesn't mean that we're doing them. They would come back, and there's a significant discussion about Mallaryville. A couple that you will see now that are routine, the facilities restoration at $800,000. The way the 20-year plan works out, we do $800,000 of work every 3 years. I'm sorry, each year for 3 years. We take a 2-year pause, and we come back for another 3 years of facility restoration. That schedule was meant to balance the capital plans, but there is a significant commitment ongoing to facilities restoration. The other significant recurring commitment is to the Road and Bridge Improvement Program. You'll see several slides here where it's $1.2 million. I think by the last year it bumps up to $1.8 million. And then some specific projects. Come 2017, we're in the process then of building the bus stop at the health department, something we've talked about for a long time. Some work on Coddington Road, I think it's at the Burns Road intersection. And then the ongoing Road and Bridge Program is the other big item there. And now we're getting later in the plan. Now it's pretty much just the ongoing things, Freeze Road being the exception, large expense for a bridge there. I believe that's an aided project, but it's a large face value for the project. And then come 2019, now we're back with another round of facilities restoration. The road and bridge improvement program per the capital plan is up to $1.8 million. Coddington is in there as a large, large item that is totally dependent on the receipt of federal aid to be able to pay for that. So it would not go forward without that giant injection of aid. The aquifer study is a constant in our plan. So when you, I'm sorry, the airport has, and Mike outlined these projects. They have a pretty aggressive capital plan over the next 5 years, $24 million. Again, many of these are dependent upon the receipt of federal aid. And Mike talked tonight, Mike Call talked about the terminal security expansion. That's a big one at 6.2. We've made a commitment to this legislature that before that would go forward, we have to assure ourselves that there's enough passenger revenue to pay for it, because that's the premise, and certainly come back to the legislature for a discussion about whether that should go forward and when. You've approved money for the design on that already. Similarly, in the solid waste fund, this is self-supporting projects, but the facility is now 20 years old, so there's improvements necessary to it that they spread out over the five-year period and then work at Caswell. Very quickly, just to show you what this means, the green line is existing debt service. So if we didn't do anything else, debt service is going to go down because we pay it off. It gets retired after a while. So that's the green line is what would happen if we didn't do anything else. The black line is the aquifer. I think that's the aquifer that's in that constant. Then if you look at what will happen.
Why does the green line stop going down at 2017?
Just the schedule of debt. I think if you ran it on another 5 years, Peter, it would head towards zero. Just when we borrowed that money. There's, and the reason Rick has gone gray in the beard, at least, is we're in the process of borrowing a lot of money right now for projects that have been authorized by you, but the debt hasn't been issued yet. So when you add that in, that's that purple line there. It adds about $1 million a year once it's at maturity to the debt service costs. Then there's another group of projects that if you look at the capital plan, you'll see that those are still proposed. You haven't authorized those yet. But if you added those in at their full and expected cost, there's the effect on debt. It would add about another $1 million at maturity. And then the top line here is, this is really the one to look at. So we're currently at about $5 million, a little over that in annual debt service. It bumps up a bit in 2016, comes back down in 2017, then a gradual increase. So we stay in that mid $5 million range over the next five-year period. And then this is an important chart, I think. So there's that same line that shows you projected debt service costs. And then if we continue to raise our levy, as by policy we said we would do by 5%, that's how much money we will raise through that
0.5%.
Annual. I'm sorry, 0.5%. For those who are listening, 0.5%. This is what happens. This is how much money is raised if we keep increasing our levy by 0.5% and allocating that growth to cover capital. So you can see that our revenues exceed our expenses, and that's kind of what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a capital reserve, which would give us the capacity to do other projects, perhaps less dependent on debt in the future. So that's a quick picture of the capital programming.
Question for Joe Dooley.
If we stuck to what we had originally said of having 0.75% increase, we would be able to build the bus stop at the health department sooner, which is something that it seems to me is important enough that we should do that. And I would like to be able to just wholeheartedly support the capital program, but I don't like this pushing of things off when I don't think they absolutely have to be pushed off. So.
If I can respond?
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's consistent with the 20-year plan that the legislature has approved. I think the scheduling of the bus stop is consistent with what the legislature approved in that 20-year plan.
I understand.
So we're not deferring it.
I understand that. And the problem came for me when you decided and presented to the legislature that we didn't need to make 0.75% in where we had said we were going to. I'm not arguing with you that everybody else just followed your lead happily, but I am continuing to not be happy about it and mention it because we could still change that.
I understand. And before we made that decision to back it down from three quarters to a half, we looked carefully at that chart to make sure we had plenty of capacity to pay debt service on that half-point increase. And we do, and we'll have a one slide that I showed you during the budget presentation was the capital reserve that will exist within a relatively short period of time, which is pretty significant.
Anything else for Joe? Carol?
Jim, I have a couple of questions that are about, I went back to Joe's presentation at the beginning of the budget, and I'm not sure when the right time.
Well,
so some of the assumptions
right now,
in the budget. Okay.
Right now.
Okay. So one of them has to do with the number. I couldn't find where in the budget. Well, we may not put it in there, but the tax cap, the governor's tax cap that's always talked about is 2%, but we have it in there at a certain percent, but now the governor's allowing us sort of, we have updated numbers from where we started.
Right.
Can you tell me what the delta is there, what the difference?
The first number we looked at was 2.36%. The last estimate was 2.65%. We're still looking at that number, so you know, because there's sales tax credits that need to be applied. We need to factor that in. Based on what we're seeing, it will not reduce the cap below that 265. If anything, it might give us a little more cap authority. But the delta between the 2.36 originally and the 2.65, which was our last estimate, is about $138,000. So put differently, and I would encourage all of us not to go right to that last penny, but you can increase the levy by $138,000 and still stay within the tax cap. And again, that's based on current estimate, and we're still working to make sure we've got it to perfection.
Okay, and then the other one was where, you may not be able to answer this immediately, but where in the budget we have the exact number for the solid waste fee. You had talked about it. I went back to my notes, and it was 300,000, rough number, I think, but I was tired.
It's really hard to tease that out of the budget. I'm not sure that we say in the solid waste budget, here's what the fee is. The fee is currently $56. The proposed fee is $52. Each dollar is $50,000, give or take. So by reducing it $4, It basically reflected a $200,000 decrease in revenue produced by that fee. So, again, it's $1 equals $50,000.
So we must have that must be reflected in revenues somewhere, like the $56 must be. And where would that be, in the capital budget or the?
No, I think it's probably dispersed throughout her budget. If you'd like, we'll try to give you a consolidated picture. We can show you how everything lines up. But I will tell you, it's one of the easier things to remember here. 1 equals 50. So $1 is $50,000.
No, I was asking because my notes from your original presentation was 300,000. I may have written it down wrong.
I could have said it wrong. I could have said it wrong.
Anything else for Joe? All right, let me tell you what the process is from here on. This concludes the presentations by all the departments. We have voting meetings on October 14, October 16, and October 20 scheduled. What we would like is if there are recommended changes to the budget, that if you call Kevin, he has a wonderful sheet that we will put them all in. He's showing that to you now. You would call Kevin on the next 4 days. By the end of business on October 9th, we would like to have those in so that the administration can contact department heads, et cetera, to be here in the first voting meeting when your resolution
is being presented. And that's kind of where we are now. So the important date is October 9th by end of business, on October 9th. If you have, and we don't start our voting meetings until the following week, so you have all weekend, 3-4 days, to think about what you want to do and get them to Kevin. Questions about that? Carol?
Yes, but if things come up as we're discussing, I assume that's not will you be coming back to us and saying, well, you didn't get it in by October 9th, so you can't be moved to...
The first round, we'd like them in by October 9th at 4 o'clock. Then it's going to have to be quicker because we will have a meeting on the 14th, and if we have to come back on the 16th, you're going to have to do it really quickly so that people can be contacted, departments can be contacted to be here to answer questions and see how it all plays out. It's no different than we've done for the last 2 or 3 years. Pretty good process, and I think if you call the office, it will work out. Anyone have any questions about what we're doing? End of business on October 9th. Thank you all.
And budget forum is next week as well?
The budget forum is next Wednesday at 7 p.m. in the library.
And that will be basically Joe's presentation with Q&A?
Song and dance, I guess.
That's kind of been the structure that we followed. Yeah, I just do the same presentation I made at the beginning.
And then we'll take questions from the public. 7. In the Borg Warner, right? What? Yeah, it's a library board one. Anyone else? Anything? Thank you all for the first 6 meetings, and we're about, well, I don't know, halfway through the process, maybe a little bit more. Appreciate your indulgence.